Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 196. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, trying intentionally to sound more exciting than I did last week. With me today, James Jones.
Hey.
Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
And special guest, Andy Gergen.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
It's the Drew MG, and he's stepping in for the MCJL. That's John Lindemann. He's out again this week. He's at a wedding, and he should be back next week as we gear up for even more pre-E3 festivities. We're actually going to get started with that this week. That's coming up after the next segment. And one more point of business up front. You might have noticed that we're getting close to episode 200. We haven't talked about it a whole lot, but I have some ideas. Probably these other guys have some ideas of what we'd like to do. And I bet you have some ideas. And I can't guarantee that we're going to take a whole lot of audience requests. I feel like most of them will be like, bring back so-and-so who used to do the podcast.
And get rid of so-and-so who does it now.
That may or may not. Yeah, that may or may not happen depending on logistics and time. But we will definitely consider that. If you have any other ideas in terms of features that you want us to talk about, send us an email, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we will begin compiling those and thinking about what to do with them. And if anyone's actually been listening since the very beginning, you have my special thanks, because you've been through a lot.
Nice.
So with that said, we're going to jump into new business, and as our guest, Andy is up first.
Awesome. I basically have just two games to talk about, and the first one has already been covered kind of extensively by James last week. But
poorly, apparently.
Yeah. That would be Mario Galaxy 2. I got that the day after it came out. It came from Amazon, next day delivery. And I haven't played a ton of it. I think I put maybe 2 or 3 hours into it. I'm like 20 stars in. I think I just got to the second or third world. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a whole lot to add to what James has already said, because it really is exactly what you expect of it. It's more of the same, which is a fantastic thing, because the first one was really, really good. I like the way Yoshi controls. Yoshi controls really, really well in the game. Way better than in Sunshine, where I thought in Sunshine it was pretty superfluous.
It was really disappointing. I'm sure Greg probably feels the most strongly of any of us about Yoshi.
Yeah, it was a perfunctory.
It's pretty bad.
Really.
Yeah, the fact that he dissolved in water was just so annoying.
I thought that was amusing, if not almost sadistic.
I feel like they just probably couldn't figure out how to make him work in the water. You know, either they couldn't get the animations right, or they couldn't get the controls right, and so they just gave up and said, let's do a Superman fog here. And
I guess the way you get around that is to set your next game in outer space, where there's not as much water to worry about.
Yeah.
So really, Yoshi works really well. The pointer mechanic with the tongue is very well implemented. I like it. It makes you feel powerful, which is a way that Yoshi hasn't really felt in any Mario game, I don't think, since the first time I remember seeing him, which was in Mario World. I thought Yoshi felt powerful in that game, and I don't know that I've felt that in a Mario game since then.
Yeah, he basically is the be-all, end-all killing machine.
Does he run away when you get hit?
Yeah, but he doesn't run off a ledge, from what I can tell.
He doesn't run real far, either. He kind of just runs around a little bit of circle. He disappears kind of quickly, though.
Yeah, I wondered how that would work in 3D, because it's not like he can just shoot off in a straight line, because you might never be able to catch up with him.
It seems like most of the places where they give you Yoshi, it's for a spot that you need Yoshi on, so it's not like you can really lose him. Mm-hmm. If you do, they just give you another egg, so it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, I mean, they basically rain Yoshi eggs on you like it's, I don't know, they're everywhere.
The parts with Yoshi are actually pretty challenging. Like, one of the very first things you do with Yoshi is you have to run around kind of Sonic the Hedgehog style up a vertical wall using a power-up that makes him run incredibly fast. And one of the things that they ask you to do sort of for a bonus is to get all of the coins as you run up this vertical wall. But the second you hit any sort of object, of course, you fall back to the beginning.
Yes.
And so getting all of those coins requires a lot of patience and practice. And so it seems like not only have they made Yoshi feel more powerful, but they've also made it more – they made the sections with him more of a challenge, which is really cool.
Yeah.
It's well done. So yeah, I mean, Mario Galaxy is exactly what I hoped it would be. I haven't played a lot of the first one in a couple of years. I haven't really touched it since I got 120. I think I'm among those who started with Luigi and got like 4 stars and then kind of called it a day.
Same as me.
So every so often I pick it back up and say, I'm going to start playing through Luigi now. But, you know, it never really happened.
Yeah, he did better than I did. Like I basically, in this game, I did get 120. I'm like, done.
Yeah. Well, and Galaxy is the only Mario game I've ever gotten all 120 in, so yeah. I was actually pretty proud of the fact that I got it. So proud, in fact, that I didn't feel compelled to go back and play anymore, apparently. But that's pretty much all I got to say about it. It's really good. I mean, of course, it's really good. The other game that I've been playing, I kind of dipped into the backlog when I realized I might have an appearance on the show. And I pulled out Godfather Black Hand Edition, which is something I've had on the shelf for a little over a year now. I bought it for, I think, dirt cheap, or maybe I got it from GooseX. I don't really remember. But, you know, I had never really played it since I got it. I just kind of had it on the shelf for one of those days, like, well, yesterday, I guess. And, yeah, it's really good.
It is really good.
And I've been hearing how good it was for a number of years now. I had several friends who had played it, and they had told me that I was in the wrong, so to speak, for not having played it yet. So it's not like I should be surprised that it was really, really good. But the even more surprising thing to me is that I don't really even care for Grand Theft Auto that much. I've never played more than a couple hours of any GTA game. And I think the main difference is really that I care about the missions in Godfather. Like, I want to see the story unfold. I want to see, you know, how everything gets tied into the movie. I actually, like, care about the character that I'm playing. And on top of that, I kind of like that the stuff they ask you to do aside from the missions is less overwhelming than it is in a GTA game.
Yeah, well, it's less of a sandbox than GTA. I mean, in Godfather, yeah, it's absolutely more mission-based in general. And I think really my only complaint about it, although you could probably look at it as a strength, is that the city's not that interesting to just run around in. And right. So you tend to stay more focused on the missions, and ultimately the pacing is better. And the game is more about these missions, and like you said, I mean, the missions are interesting, and the story is, I think, shockingly good, considering it's based on a movie, and especially how it's dancing in and out of really a sacred movie in The Godfather.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The way it does that without feeling sacrilegious and without seeming totally contrived is kind of amazing, I think.
Well, and the voice acting is really phenomenal, too. I mean, they have some of the actors from the original movie. They don't have all of them. But the ones they do have, even the ones that aren't from the original movie, I mean, everything is really well done. The production values, just they just seem on. They just really kind of nailed it. I mean, there's of course, some graphical hitches. It is an open-world game, and it comes with all the fun little kind of bugs of any kind of GTA-style game. But it's all nitpicking, really. I'm really enjoying it. I started it last night about like four or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm already like 5.5-6 hours in. So I played a lot couple of days. And
it's probably the best game of that kind on the Wii still.
Yeah, I mean, the competition's not real strong, to be honest. I mean,
no, there's not that much competition on Wii, but
no, I would say it's better than the first two GTA games on PlayStation 2 as well. Maybe not better than the third one, at least in terms of...
Wait, by the first two, you mean GTA 3 and Vice City? And by the third one, you mean San Andreas, not GTA 3?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I guess there are some people who think that Vice City is better than San Andreas, I guess. I would say it's probably better than the worst two of those three, depending on your opinion of what those worst two are. But yeah, it's the graphics are really pretty decent. I mean, you have to kind of adjust to the early late 2006 kind of graphical style.
Yeah.
And especially it's pretty jarring when you just got done playing Galaxy 2.
Well, and it's an up port too, isn't it?
Well, it definitely has some new features.
The motion control is pretty good. I like how...
The aiming is pretty good too.
Yeah, when you lock onto an enemy, you can use the pointer control to sort of control what part of the enemy you want to shoot. And that could be a problem if they let you get free reign over the pointer, but really you don't. If you move your pointer to the upper left hand, it'll just kind of move to the guy's shoulder. Like, you don't have to do a whole lot of precise aiming. Mm-hmm. You can just sort of point into a region. And it helps you, like, if you want to, like, bring the guy down to his knees or disarm him by shooting his gun hand, or if you just want to kill him, you can do that too. But it gives you the options, which is pretty nice, actually.
Yeah, it's really intelligent use of motion control, I think.
Yeah, it really is. And like the one of the things that you can do to sort of bring a bad guy down quietly is you can strangle him. And basically what that means is you're holding down on the B and the Z button, and you're grabbing the guy, and you're just shaking him violently for about 30 to 40 seconds. And, you know, that's actually a really good motion control effect. Like, you really do kind of feel like you're strangling the life out of someone.
It's visceral.
Bravo.
I'll go next, and I've been playing more PS3 crap. I actually did get my copy of Galaxy 2 today, but Greg, we will share our torture.
So Greg doesn't have a PS2 and you don't have, I mean, Greg doesn't have the game and you don't have a Wii.
Yours is self-inflicted, Johnny, because you couldn't be bothered to take it. Don't get with your false equivalency. You sicken me, sir.
All I have to say is just remember, at least you're not in Australia.
Yeah, did you? I don't think they're getting sin and punishment 2 at all.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so on my PS3, I've been playing really two games the past week. First, Little Big Planet, and it's been interesting. I mean, the sequel was just announced, coming out later this year. I'm not sure how interested I am in it right now, because I'm not really enjoying Little Big Planet that much. And it surprises me. I mean, it seems like a Nintendo-like game. I mean, it is, you know, it's a 2D side-scrolling platformer. It's very Mario in concept, but the execution of it feels so un-Nintendo. It's weird. I mean, I can't imagine getting that excited for this game when it was, like, being demoed to the press, because you heard so many glowing things about it, and it kept getting delayed, so for a whole year, I kept hearing people talk about how it was their most anticipated game, and they thought it was the game of, the game of the show at E3 that year and everything, and I'm playing it now, and I'm thinking, it just doesn't feel right. The platforming does not feel good at a fundamental level to me.
Wasn't a lot of that based on the level editor?
I'm sure the demos were heavy on that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it was the same reason that
Scribble Notes.
Yeah, that it came out because, like,
the high concept.
Yeah, look at what you can do. Oh my God. And then when you get like, shit, I can't do any of this.
But Little Big Planet got really, really, really strong reviews even when it came out.
Very strong. Extremely.
I am playing the Game of the Year edition, and this would not have been near the top of my list if I played it.
Apparently, there was a lot of games in the year last year.
Well, this is the game's 2 years old now, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. I know that there's been at least 6 or 7 games that were Game of the Year. For that
oh
year.
Sure, yeah.
Not for every year nowadays.
Every year, yeah, really. Yeah. But you know, I was interested in picking it up for a while. It seemed like a good value and everything. And then Sony just put it on their greatest hits. So it was $30 for the Game of the Year edition, which has some bonus content. And I was like, okay, that sounds good. Mm. I picked it up, and yeah, I really think it controls like shit. And Moro, it's not, you know, I've heard a lot of people say the jumping's kind of floaty. And that's a problem. It's a big problem. But it's not just that. It's the way the levels are put together, because they're all based on physics. And I understand that groundwork probably allows them to do the level editor the way it is and for people to put these things in there. But the way everything, I think, Greg, you mentioned this when you were talking about it. It feels like everything's kind of made of some material, right?
Yeah, that's the look.
And everything feels like it's put together with strings and, you know, in some cases, nuts and bolts and little pivots and things like that. It's a very charming aesthetic, but to me it doesn't translate into gameplay that well, because things never really feel solid. You know, when you're moving around, everything feels like it's teetering and it's falling apart as you move around on it. It feels like somebody just kind of stacked up a bunch of shit.
Yeah, the toy box thing. I mean, that is what they're going for, definitely. Yeah.
And I find it very uncomfortable to play through. I mean, not actually physically uncomfortable, but I don't like the feel in a platformer. I don't like the feel that the platforms are all shaking when I stand on them. And that's basically what you've got here. There's really no solid ground. Hardly ever. And when you move switches, when you move blocks around, a lot of times it feels like all that's happening in a very loose way. There's nothing really discrete about the game. Everything just feels like you're kind of pushing things around whether you want to or not. I'm not sure I'm describing it well, but it just does not feel tight. The game feels very loose. Mm. It's very loosely put together. I mean, you know, clearly it was done with a lot of care. And I think there's a lot of imagination. I think the visual style is really good. But, man, the way the game feels as you play through it, the way the levels are put together, I'm not that big of a fan of it. And I'm probably halfway through the story mode. I played a few user-created levels that I thought were interesting. But even the really good ones, I mean, there's some that are included on the Game of the Year edition disc that were pulled from the community. They're like the best community-made games. And even those feel very much like the ones in the story mode. They feel just really loose and kind of put – they feel like they've been put together with a construction kit.
And they kind of are. I mean,
well, obviously, but
I guess the difference what I'm saying is if there was like a level editor in a Mario game, you would play those user created levels and feel like, well, these feel like they were put together with a level editor. The problem is the story, like the main levels that the developer created for this, feel like they were made with a level editor. They don't.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? They don't feel polished. They don't feel like something professionally made. And to me, they should. So maybe this is an area that can be improved in the sequel. I don't know. I mean, I've read a good bit about the sequel. I don't really understand the background, the technical stuff that they're doing to it, but it does not feel right to me.
It kind of tells me that they spent way more time working on like the framework of the game than they actually made assembling the game out of it.
Yeah,
that's kind of what it sounds like, is they wanted to make sure the first product of Little Big Planet was the level editor, and mm-hmm. then the second product was the game that the developers made with that level editor.
It is like Scribblenauts in that sense.
Yeah, and in fact, in Scribblenauts, you get that same feeling sometimes, where it's like, well, I have to stack this crap together, but nothing kind of works like physics dictates it probably should, because it's all just kind of loose.
I got on with it quite a lot better, I think. It was a very different feel from what I'm used to with 2D games or games that play in 2D, although this has the little layers, like the three.
Oh, that's so janky. The three
layers. Yeah, that doesn't really work that well, I think, because it's just switching between, it's kind of unreliable.
And it's hard to tell visually which layer you're on.
Yeah, it can be quite subtle. So, I mean, that part of it I wasn't a big fan of, but in general, I certainly see what you mean, though, in terms of it doesn't feel as tight. It does feel not quite as satisfying as something that's got that kind of harder design edge to it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, if at the same time for me, it was different. You know, I've played loads of games that play, you know, sort of really crisply or whatever.
Yeah.
And I just kind of, I did like the physics kind of toy box part of it. It was something, I suppose, more from a stylistic point of view, perhaps, than a sort of a raw gameplay point of view, mm-hmm. in terms of kind of the more kind of screwing around kind of element than the, like, okay, this is a very deliberately put together challenge that I need to overcome. Although, I mean, there was some of those, I think, that kind of delivered in that area. But I mean, in terms of this issue of the polish or the tightness of the levels not feeling quite there, it's a bit like Bangaio. In a completely different way, but Bangaio is very much the same thing in terms of, like, basically any of the levels in Bangaio you can make with the level editor that's mm-hmm. in the game, Bangaio Spirits for DS.
But the mechanics are a lot more refined in Bangaio. The way the controls work, and, I mean, in Bangaio you have all these different attacks, and the developers exploit the nature of those attacks in order to create puzzle levels that are built around them. And it is very satisfying when you solve one of those. And I haven't encountered anything analogous to that in Little Big Planet.
Yeah, I mean, I think gameplay-wise, you know, I mean, it's a treasure game. That's what they care about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's no surprise there. But the similarities, just in the sense that the levels in Bangaio, just they feel certainly quite a bit more sort of generic than other stuff that Treasure does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of it is just in the visual style, and, you know, there's not that many backgrounds, and there's not a lot of specific purposed assets or anything, because it's just all stuff that you can make yourself. So, you know, that I think that's, in that sense, it's more of an aesthetic thing than it is a gameplay thing. But it is the same sort of situation where if you were placing the constraint on yourself that your levels are going to have, you know, fundamental similarities with levels that anyone can make, it seems difficult to bring to the fore quite that same level of polish and rigor in the design that you would get if you were just making a standard game.
Yeah, well, I don't want to harp on it too much more, but it is interesting to me in that I'm coming to Little Big Planet a couple of years after most other people, and so I have the benefit of sort of hindsight and not being super hyped up on it or anything. And you know, obviously I was expecting to like it more than this, even though I didn't want to spend that much money on it. But I'm surprised at how little I'm enjoying it so far, I have to say. I mean, I don't know if you remember the level where you're taught about explosives, and mm-hmm. you have to put on a rocket pack and carry these explosive bombs around to blow up some pathways for yourself. That is incredibly frustrating, because the controls are so loose, and if you just knock into a wall just a little bit too hard, that thing will blow up and kill you.
Good. Perfect.
That's fine. except it's the control's fault. You know, you end up just having to play it really gingerly because there's so much looseness in the physics of it.
I mean, there's a few cases of that later in the game where some levels that demand a certain kind of precision that become sort of frustrating. Although, you know, in general, the way the checkpoint's set up and all that is pretty forgiving, but in certain cases, it kind of stumbles. Like there's a one in sort of Japanese themed sort of environment where you're jumping across the tips of these upright sort of paper platforms, and that doesn't really work. I just remember that scene being incredibly more difficult than the rest of the game, and just you could pass it once, you're jumping from these little tips of platform one to the other, but then to replicate that performance was very difficult because the controls are the way they are. So that level of precision was just ill-suited to the gameplay fundamentals that they put in there.
Yeah. And it is just interesting. I mean, especially in light of a lot of other people I know and talk to are playing Galaxy right now, Galaxy 2, and this is just a complete polar opposite in terms of the way the levels are designed and the way the characters control. It is an interesting contrast, that's all. So one other game, this is pretty easy to pretty quick hit here, but I've been putting some more time into Pixel Junk Monsters, which I bought recently when it was on sale. I got it for $5, and I like Eden quite a bit. I really like Shooter, even though I blew through it in a couple of days. It's a little bit content light, but it's really, really good. And Pixel Junk Monsters is, again, a game that I've heard such good things about, and now that I'm playing it, I'm finding that I don't really enjoy it that much, and chiefly because it's way too difficult. I mean, it's shockingly difficult. And it is tower defense. It's, you know, by the Pixel Junk guys at Q Games. And they've also done a tower defense for DSiWare.
Yeah, Starship Defense.
Right.
It has different names in different places, but like Starship Defense.
I've heard good things about that, but then I heard good things about Monsters. And Monsters, I like the art style of it. I think the mechanics are, I mean, it's tower defense. It's not that original. It probably felt more original back when it first came out, but
yeah,
it is brutally difficult. And I've played plenty of tower defense. I mean, I feel like I'm decent at the genre in general, and I know what I'm doing. And I'm playing on regular difficulty, and it's just kicking my ass. It's unbelievable how hard it is, even on the easier levels, the so-called easier levels. It's like, wow. And the levels are really long, so you might play through for 10, 15 minutes and lose on the last wave and then have to, you know, basically start over again. Kind of frustrating.
So, I mean, does it do anything that's particularly new in the tower defense mold? I mean, I feel like you have to.
Yeah, I mean, you do now, especially. Again, this game is a couple years old.
It's been,
at the time,
been a lot of games in the genre in between.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I understand. I feel like that genre's kind of been beaten up even by like free flash games. I feel like if you put a retail product out there, it always had to do something special.
Well, this is and there's a few different types. So this is of the type that you're controlling a character.
Active tower defense versus
You don't just have a mouse cursor. You're controlling a character, so you have to physically walk over to the place where you want to build a tower, which takes time. So sometimes you're kind of trying to outrun the enemies in order to set up a tower before they get there, that kind of thing. And the other part is the enemies go through on a predetermined path, so you can't deflect their routes. You can't guide them down the route that you want. You know, they never attack you or your towers, but you can never put a tower in their pathway, ever. They're going to go a predetermined route, which lends it some predictability in terms of there is probably a right way to play every level, but at the same time, it's really frustrating because there is one right way to play every level.
Yeah, I feel like that's detrimental on both ends, because it means the game becomes super hard if you don't know that way, and if you do know that way, there's basically no replayability there.
I think that's a fair point, and it seems like the way they balance that out is just by making it really brutally difficult.
Awesome. I know another tower defense game you at least toyed around with was the Final Fantasy themed one on WiiWare.
Yes, I do own My Life as a Dark Lord, and
yes,
that's an interesting one because it's so
weird.
Limited. Your interactivity with it is so limited because you just go up and down floors and build towers. So it's very, very strict as to what your options are at any given time. And there is no route. The guys just come.
No, they go up.
Yeah, they go up. That's it. So it's in some ways it's a little simpler than some of these other games, but at the same time, it feels like that can make it easier to figure out a success strategy. But I mean, that game's pretty difficult too. The difference is you can sort of grind in the Final Fantasy one. It's not pleasant, and it doesn't help that much, but if you feel like that will make the key difference, you can try it. So that there's some differences. I mean, I think that's a pretty good tower defense game for $10. The best one I've played is Defense Grid, which is a PC game. It's on Xbox Live Arcade too. I haven't played that version, but I think it's really good. You can get it on Steam for $5 or $10, and I don't know if it's on Mac yet, but I think that one's really good.
Yeah, I was just trying to run through all the tower defense games I know you had played.
Yeah, it's not certainly not all of them, but enough that, you know, I feel like I have a pretty good grasp on the genre.
A representative sample.
Yeah, yeah. And then the last thing I want to say on new business this week is very quick postscript on Heavy Rain, because I was pretty high on it when I talked about it last week.
This is sad.
I was having a good time with Heavy Rain, and I didn't know how far along I was. It turns out I was about an hour from beating it, maybe a little more, which is fine. You know, I thought that was a possibility, but it's not the amount of time that I had left. It's what happened in that 1 hour. Because the next day, I went ahead and beat it, played through the rest of it, and the story went from being really interesting and really tightly wound and good at the point when we recorded last week to, in the last hour, it turns into complete horseshit.
This is bullshit, man. Wow. This is bullshit.
Complete horseshit.
And that kind of reminds me of my thoughts on Indigo Prophecy.
Yeah, well, I think Heavy Rain commits a worse sin than Indigo Prophecy, because at least in the previous game, it goes wacky a lot sooner. Even less than halfway through the game, it's all paranormal and totally unpredictable. Sure. And silly. And yeah, at the end, it gets even crazier. I mean, it really makes absolutely no sense by the end. But at least you were kind of prepared for that. I mean, your main character had already come back from the dead and had sex with this woman for no reason. And
there is always a reason to have sex with a woman, Johnny.
But he was dead. Like, he's pale. Like, he looks like a zombie.
We all have needs.
I felt like in Indigo Prophecy, they just cut out hours 5 and 6 out of an 8-hour game.
Yeah.
So, like, you'd kind of jump from hour 4 to hour 7.
Unfortunately, and that's similar to what happens in Heavy Rain. It does feel like it feels like they wrote the beginning and the end, and then started writing everything in the middle to make them connect, and they never finished the connective part in the middle.
So basically you're saying they can't end stories.
Well, the ending was pretty good and effective. It was just out of place. It just wasn't justified.
Is that because of choices you made in the game?
See, that's what I thought at first. I thought at first, well, it came to the point when I found out who the killer was, the Origami Killer. And, you know, the whole game is building up to you discovering the identity of this killer and then doing something about it. And it's sometimes you might even think you know who it is, but you're probably wrong. And when I found out who it was, I was like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, you know it's going to be a character that you've met before. That's the only thing that would make sense. You know, I mean, it has to be one of these characters that you've encountered or played as. And when they tell you who it is, when I found out who it was, I was like, did I do something wrong? I mean, I thought maybe I had just made some poor decisions and had come up with, like, the worst possible outcome. So I looked online and I thought, you know, there must be, like, a better version of this, you know, that you could get to if you did things differently. And there are some sort of different resolutions to the final scene, and there's some different things that can happen that lead up to that final scene, but the identity of the killer is always the same no matter what.
And does it always just not make sense?
Exactly. It's a twist of the highest order. I mean, and I get that it's supposed to be this big story twist, and that would be fine. I like twists. I like Usual Suspects. But it is totally unjustified. I mean, it's totally unreasonable. If I went back and played through it all again, which I'm absolutely not ever going to do in the rest of my life, if I did
that... Well, see, there you go. The creator got his wish. You're not going to go back and play it again.
Yeah. No, if I did that, I would become even more incredulous as to that twist as I went through it and reviewed all the scenes that I had played through before that, because this twist literally comes out of nowhere and makes no fucking sense. And I just, at that point, I mean, I finished the game, but I just, I lost it. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Because it had built up such a good foundation. I mean, I was really into the story. I thought, this is pretty good. You know, this is pretty good stuff. And then at the end, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it doesn't get paranormal. It's not completely, you know, absurd like Indigo Prophecy, but it just throws away any feasibility of the plot.
So you're saying that zombie sex saves Indigo Prophecy from this fate, basically?
Well, at least it's funny.
It is funny.
Heavy Rain is at no point funny.
Yeah, that's what I was saying last week. The idea of, you know, stuff that doesn't feel right is more of a problem. It's something that's more grounded.
Yeah.
You know, to start with.
Right. It is. I'm a lot more pissed off about it than I was in Indigo Prophecy. And it just, Heavy Rain went from a game that I was, you know, highly recommending that people go out and try to, at this point, I'm not sure I'd even recommend playing it at all.
So if you already bought it.
Because when it's a narrative game, the narrative payoff is everything. You know, I mean, that's the, you know, it seems weird to say, well, you know, if you had, you know, 6 hours of fun or whatever, and then an hour of sort of befuddlement at the end, that kind of ruins everything.
Right. But it's not just like the final boss sucks. It's not like other video games where you could say that, you know?
Yes.
If you start playing this, you're going to get invested in the story and you're going to be really pissed at the end.
Awesome.
So I would just say, don't even start.
Cool.
It's really too bad. It's such a loss.
I want to summarize Johnny's new business. I'm going to piss on these three popular PS3 games.
Yep.
Well done, sir.
Yep.
You have pulled the anti-John Lindemann. Nice work.
What do you mean by actually picking up the controller?
These are all games that I wanted to like, that I was excited to play.
Yeah, I was probably going to play Heavy Rain at some point, but now I probably won't.
I honestly cannot recommend it.
You scared me off.
David Cage needs a story editor. Not as bad as Kojima, but almost as bad.
but Kojima falls into that, yeah, this is bullshit, but it starts out as bullshit, too. I mean,
glorious bullshit.
Yeah, it's
right.
Just like, I am going to give you the most bullshit you've ever seen delivered to you in 40-minute intervals. Enjoy.
I haven't played any Metal Gear Solid games, so maybe I'm not the most apt to speak on this, but it seems to me like Heavy Rain is a game that's literally about nothing but its own story. And Metal Gear Solid at least has other gameplay elements that it sort of couches in there as well. So, like, right. It seems like a bigger sin for Heavy Rain to screw up its story.
It's really an unforgivable sin. I mean, it's to the point where I don't think I would play any other game made by this guy.
Because, oh, my God.
Well, I mean, he wrote...
Now you're building my intrigue up again.
I know. Now I'm tempted. I'm like, how mad would I get?
Sorry. Fool me twice. Shame on me.
Like, a 1 hour sequence has completely destroyed his perspective of this guy's talent.
Well, look, my final word on Heavy Rain is I was looking forward to a Scream 1 ending, and instead I got a Scream 2 ending. I think you know what that means.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, at least it's not I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay, enough of that, and now it's up to James.
Yes, to support the home front here.
Mm-hmm.
So I, having, as I said earlier, cast aside Galaxy like a plague. which, to be clear, it's not because I hate Galaxy, as was implied in the talkback thread to our last episode.
Mm.
It's just because that game was not meant to be played in 3 days. It just wasn't.
Are you saying you got it out of your system?
Yes, and then some.
Is that because you took a Galaxative?
Wow. That's horrible. Thank you, John.
That's the episode title, you know.
No, it's not.
From last week. It's done been broughten.
Oh, God. How did I miss that?
Well, because you don't listen to the show.
It's not true. I listen to about every other show.
Okay, well.
Busy man, Johnny. Busy
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
I'm busy man playing Trauma Team.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I wish I was.
It's in stores, man. Go get it.
How awesome is Trauma Team?
It's pretty awesome. It's basically, I mean, it's not Trauma Center, which is probably a good thing. Because Trauma Center on the Wii, as I understand it, did not work.
No. Oh, it works. It works.
Does
really
it?
Well. Yeah. The problem is that I've had enough Trauma Center. Because they
were like four Trauma Centers now, isn't it?
They made a lot of Trauma Centers in a very short period of time.
Yes, they did. They dumped those out quick.
Don't get me wrong. Trauma Center Second, not Second Opinion. That's the port of the original DS game. But Trauma Center New Blood is excellent. That is a really good Wii game.
Really so good. There is Trauma Center in this game, as you might guess from its name, but mm-hmm. that's only about a sixth of the game. So the team, the titular team, is six different doctors that you get to play with, each with their own game style. So one of them is basically the doctor style surgery. That's like six or seven surgeries. There's two other types of surgery. There's orthopedic surgery, which if you don't know what that means, okay. It's like it's surgery on bones. So you spend a lot of time resetting bones, putting together bone fragments, screwing in plates, drilling holes in bones. There's also endoscopic surgery, which plays really differently because it's an endoscope, which is either goes in through one end or the other of the body, if you understand what I'm saying. And you use it to – you sort of fish it through the body to find – usually they're looking for things like ulcers and things.
That seemed like the most interesting from the videos that I saw.
So first off, we had discussed in the past – that pushing the Wii Remote forward and pulling it back doesn't work, mm-hmm. which they actually have you physically feed the endoscope through. Ooh. And it surprisingly does work pretty well. Okay. I'm not sure.
It made you throw up.
A little bit. It's a little unpleasant to think about. So it's six different stories, but they're all tied together. Each doctor has their own story, but they're kind of tied together. Sometimes they'll have events that interlap with each other. They do a pretty good job of putting them on a common timeline so you can try to keep in line with the story. But those three are your primary surgery operations. There's an emergency doctor who basically goes to the scenes of calamities and provides first aid and extended care up until the point the patient's evacuated.
I want to congratulate you on using the word calamities in a sentence.
You're welcome. So it's things like burns, deep lacerations, removal of fragments, you know, applying an IV and a tourniquet, stuff like that. And then those are all pretty similar to the trauma center stuff. You know, they're relatively short. You have to be really careful in every case except for the endoscope and the orthopedic surgeon. You know, that you have to keep their heart rate in check. Mm. In the other case, it's just you have a fixed number of mistakes you can make and you fail. And then there's two other modes that are vastly different from those four, which is one is the diagnostician, where you get a patient in front of you and you have to do a visual inspection of their symptoms, interview them, and identify symptoms that they talk. So like,
so it's house.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's very much like that. It's very, very, very rooted in real medicine.
Hmm. Kind of sounds like it might play similar to like Phoenix Wright, where you kind of have to like grill them on what they're talking about. And
I'll get to that.
Yeah, it's something closer.
Yes. So the diagnostician, he basically, there's a bunch of pieces of dialogue, and it is like that. Each dialogue will pop up in a, basically it's like a word bubble. And then you use the pointer to select one if you think you want to drill into it. And if you are right, you'll get a new symptom. If you're wrong, you'll be punished and your mistake meter will go down. In that respect, it's a lot like Phoenix, right?
Sure. But
there's also things like you can use a stethoscope to listen to various bodily sounds, and they give you a method of comparing it to what a normal baseline should sound like. There's imagery, so things like CT scans, x-rays that you can compare. And so basically, as you narrow down the list of symptoms by using your computer, you slowly kind of work your list down till you identify what their disease is, and then you diagnose it. And then usually what happens is your patient winds up in surgery with one of the other surgeons after the fact.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. I like that.
But then the last one is the medical examiner. So these ain't patients. They dead.
You're a coroner.
Yes. These are both the diagnostician and the medical examiner phases are much longer. You know, they're usually about an hour long each. In the case of the coroner, this is a lot like Phoenix, right? Except obviously you don't interview your subject because they're dead. But you basically examine the body and examine their personal effects. You may or may not know anything about the issue at the time. You look for things that are of question. So, you know, wounds on the body. Maybe they have like a broken finger that's worth noting. Stuff on their clothing. And then you go back to your computer and you either send it for analysis or you take pieces of evidence that have a common theme and you connect them together to sort of turn it into better information. From that point on, you know, as the story starts, the mystery begins to either expand or become more focused on something. You can go to the scene and look for things that could be related to whatever the case is, of what caused this person to die or how they died. And eventually you kind of narrow it down using the evidence you have and making these logical connections with the pieces of evidence you're presented.
Now, James, you're not moving a character around these scenes, are you? Is it just kind of spot the picture kind of stuff?
it's point and click. So yeah. You have like three places you go to, and you just click on a menu. I want to go here now, mm-hmm. and then you're at the person's, you know, like their apartment, and you look around for things that might have contributed to their death in their apartment.
But their apartment is just like a JPEG.
Yeah, basically. I mean,
okay, so it is very much like Phoenix Wright then.
Yeah, and that's the one that's a lot like Phoenix Wright, and there is even some interviewing. Kind of, because the police will send you statements they get from witnesses, and you can kind of try to compare it to the evidence you have and say, well, that doesn't seem right. Hmm. But in that one, you have an assistant who you basically send evidence off to, and you have to listen to him be a smartass for the entire time of it. It's fantastic. The story itself is kind of like there's this epidemic that's hit, and none of the doctors really understand exactly what it is, but it causes very bad symptoms, like cancer, an extremely aggressive form of cancer. The story itself is kind of off the deep end a little bit, but it's acceptable in its weirdness, I think, because the trauma center stories were a little... I mean, for God's sakes, he had the healing touch. It's yeah. not like they were super serious.
Magical doctors, yeah.
Yeah, there's a little bit less magic going on in this particular game. But, I mean, each gameplay mode feels different. Obviously, those two, the coroner and the diagnostician, feel much different because they just are. But each one has a unique feel to it. The surgeries themselves don't feel particularly challenging, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just cut out for surgery. I don't know. I really enjoyed the hell out of this game, and it actually is much longer than I expected and even thought it was when I was playing it, because I pulled it back up today to kind of look through it and realized that my game time on there was like 20 freaking hours.
Nice.
And considering the fact the game's only, it's like $40. So yeah. it's a pretty good deal for what you're getting. And I actually really enjoyed it. The game actually does feature a two-player mode of some kind, but I haven't really gotten to try it out yet because I don't have anybody here to be my co-doctor in surgery. But I have to imagine that they probably just do the same stuff you're doing.
Yeah, they've done that before in New Blood. I would expect it similar. I mean, it's basically just another cursor on the screen.
Yeah, which I feel like in some cases would be really distracting.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to coordinate a lot. I tried it a little bit in New Blood, and I mean, it can make the game more difficult because you really have to figure out, okay, you do this while I'll do this. It's very cooperative.
Mm, so you actually have to be communicating with each other.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
That sounds like I kind of want to try that out when I get the chance, because I mean, it didn't take me long, because I've only played a little bit of the Trauma Center games. I never actually owned any of them, so I played them some, but I got to this pretty quickly, so I feel like I could probably talk somebody into playing it and get except for the Endoscope stuff. They'd probably be really grossed out by that. But that's not cooperative anyway, because you can only put one Endoscope in a guy.
Well, so you think.
Oh, well, I guess you could. It could be like when they were drilling the tunnel between France and England, but it's not going to be so good.
My experience with this franchise doesn't go past the first, like, 2 hours of the very first game. So I'm actually considering kind of just picking this up and kind of re-immersing myself in the series at this point. I mean, because the stories of the Trauma Centers, they don't run together, do they? Is it like Phoenix Wright, where the story actually, like, seems to change across the games?
It's not necessary that you've played the previous games, but there'll be certain callbacks and references to characters, I'm sure.
This game is a complete reset in that weird... because, I mean, I think it's not even set in the same... I don't remember if they actually explicitly set the Trauma Center games anywhere. But this game is explicitly set in Portland, Oregon, which when they did that, I was like, why Portland? Of all the places they could have put this game.
It's a beautiful city.
It just seemed so random. I was like, what the hell?
James, can you comment real quickly on the voice acting?
It's acceptable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot of professional voice actors that you've heard in other things before.
Okay. Cam Clark shows up. Probably somewhere.
Probably. I mean, it's not... Some of it's a little goofy, but it's not horrendous.
It's not Skycrawler's bad.
It's not, like, the worst voice acting I've heard, and even in my last 5 games I've played, let's put it that way. Okay. Because I've had some interesting ones.
I thought the voice acting in New Blood was really good, at least for the main characters.
Yeah, I would say for at least some of the main characters, it's really good, and then for some of them, it's like, okay... This isn't terrible.
Is there any character animation in the in the character portraits? Because I felt like that was kind of the next logical step.
So it's funny they didn't do that, but what they did instead was they actually animated not the portrait themselves, but what the portrait was doing. So almost like tongue in cheek, they'd have like they're walking, so they'd have the portraits bounce as they walk, like in a clearly with some humor intended in how they do it. Which for me, I was just...
It's like the Paper Mario approach to animation.
Yeah. Mm. So there was a segment where they did that after a very late game orthopedic surgery that went on for like 16 minutes, which is a long time for one of these surgeries to go on.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just dead, just physically stressed out. Because I think about it is you have to have your pointer set up with the right sensitivity because it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the sweet spot of my sensitivity is about 4 feet from my TV.
Whoa. Are you serious?
Well, it's in a small room.
That...
So for me, that just happened to be where it was working the best, which is fine. I mean, it works well enough for everywhere in the room.
I hope you have a 10-inch screen.
No.
You're sitting four feet away from it.
But I mean, like I said, I can use the pointer from anywhere in the room and it not be an issue, but that just happens to be where it is the optimal responsiveness for me for this game, which means I have to stand because there's no chair there. So this went on for like 16 minutes of me cutting bone and removing bone fragments and shaping artificial bone with a laser. And by the time it was done, I was just like physically beaten up.
Immersive.
It is. You feel like you've just performed a long ass surgery because you did.
I've always felt that way about those games, though. I've always felt like they do a really good job of like putting you in the mindset where you're kind of stressed out and it's very much precision gameplay. And if you make a lot of mistakes, the patient will die, and you will feel bad.
You do.
At least you'll be pissed.
Because the weird thing about the emergency response ones is you don't have one patient. You might have three, four. In one case, I had five patients I had to bounce between and keep them all alive with the magic serum.
Oh, yeah, the green stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was bouncing between five different patients, and what it is once you treat them well enough they can be transported, they drop off your list of patients. But I'm bouncing between them, trying to just keep them all alive, and I'm basically getting no time to do anything to them. like I'll get to cut one of their shirts open, but I have to leave now and go fix this guy. And as I move back down the list, I get to them. All right, I've closed up some wounds. I got to bounce back. That's really stressful because you're watching this gauge up at the top that tells you the status of all of your patients, and you see somebody go in the red, and you're just like, shit, I got to move now, but I'm busy cutting this guy's shirt open. I can't stop. And I lost a patient because I was in the middle of applying a tourniquet, and I couldn't jump over to him because I lost track of what I was doing. And I felt really bad. I saved like eight people.
Can't save everyone, James. I don't want to get that Ray disaster messiah complex going.
The doctor who I was working with on that particular surgery, because they come in twos, and that's the second player, basically says, well, we can't save everyone. And then your doctor goes, damn it, I have to save everyone. And I'm like, damn it, so do I. And I was like, fuck you, game.
I think the solution is to actually, there should just be a cheat code you could put in a trauma team that where your character will start like popping pills and turn into a complete asshole.
Well, you know, it's funny that the diagnostician is already an asshole. Like, they had to have been doing this knowingly.
Awesome.
Because he is an ass.
And do you ever crack the case while making a joke about the hospital administrator's cleavage?
actually. He does make comments about the hospital administrator. Yes. So
there you go.
I mean, this was very.
Do you ever play Metroid Zero Mission? Because House did that in like the pilot he did it really early. Plays Zero Mission on a silver GBA SP.
A man of refined taste.
Are you required to make two mistakes before you solve the mystery?
man, it sounds like a fascinating game. I can't wait to play it.
It really is. And the fact that they went and put the six different playstyles in there really does keep you from getting bored with it.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, everybody only has about six or seven assignments. So you don't really have the chance to get bored with them.
Yeah.
But because there's six different assignments and some of them take a long time, it still is plenty of gameplay time.
Okay, well, we've got to wrap up new business, and Greg has one last game for us.
I do. There's a couple of things I suppose I'm contractually obligated to mention. The European downer that there are currently, as I am aware, no plans for a release date for Trauma Team yet, which kind of carries on the long history of the trauma games taking absolutely ages to come to Europe, so maybe it'll happen eventually. I hope it does, because I've been, you know, Johnny always talked them up and stuff. I always thought about getting them, but they took ages to come over, and then when they do, it's not. But that, by the time they did, I was on this show, so you know I had to be current, obviously.
No,
by playing Japanese virtual console games.
There you go, so, perfect.
Greg, you should check out New Blood. I mean, that you said that one did come out.
Yeah, I do really like the idea of all these different playstyles, so I'm very much interested in that. But to be honest, New Blood's probably so cheap if I actually apply myself.
And New Blood has a lot more variety than the first one did.
Right, yeah, so there's that. And the other thing I wanted to bring up is something that just came out tonight in Europe is Rotozoa, the art style game.
Ooh. Oh,
So we kind of traded, like, you got light tracks this week, you know, on the Monday preceding the show, and now Rotozoa's come out here. But it's not called Rotozoa here. It's called Penta Tentacles. Now, the thing that really cracks me up about that is the idea that somebody thought it was really funny that it's like, well, you're some sort of weird, like, microbe that has five tentacles. We'll call it Pentacles. It's, oh, no, that's satanic. We'll call it Penta Tentacles.
That's terrible. Oh. This is one of those instances where I'm like, I'm glad John's not here because we'd be being barraged.
Perfectly acceptable wordplay with Rotozoa, you know? It's like, why did they have to do this?
Penta Tentacles. That's a terrible name.
That is a terrible name. It's so different from the rest of the, you know, the art style names are usually very sort of brief, you know, way too many syllables for an art style game, as far as I'm concerned.
It's art style Penta Tentacles.
Yeah.
That is way too long. Like, you could play the game in the amount of time it takes to say that title.
Well, we'll see. I maybe by this time next week I'll have it, but I am a naturally cautious man. And as much as I like his art style, art style games, I'll probably wait and see some of the early feedback.
I've been turned off by the tentacle.
One WiiWare game that I have been playing is the immortal But Yeah Bit Trip Runner. So I decided it's the first time I've picked up a Bit Trip game. I did play the demo for Bit Trip Beat in those halcyon days of demos. which I thought was pretty cool actually, but I just didn't get around to buying it. But with Runner, you know, it sounded, you know, up my alley. I'm a big fan of some rhythm action games. That's Rhythm Heaven. So both, you know, the GBA import Rhythm Tengoku and the DS game, I like both of those a lot. Obviously, the whole retro thing, I'm very much amenable to that. So I thought this would be a good place to start with it. And I've beaten it. I got it a couple of days ago. It doesn't take very long to complete. I mean, you know, I guess all of these games are not that long, but they are, you know, fairly challenging. And this one, certainly, there's been a lot of talk about how hard it is. And, you know, I've kind of got mixed feelings about it, really. I think it's definitely at its best, like, when you've got a lot of these quite brief levels that you play through. But they are, you know, they are uncompromising from the point of view. If you make one mistake, you go back to the start. So you start, they kind of layer on top the skills that you have to use. So you're pretty much just always doing stuff in time. And they start with just jumping, and then you have to, like, you know, kick down obstacles, slide under things, block incoming projectiles. They kind of layer on these different things. But they're all kind of, in the end, because you're running at a fixed rate, which dictates the sort of rhythm of the game, you're essentially just pressing things in time. So it's not really like a traditional platform game or anything. It is kind of like a giant rhythm Tengoku game in the sense that, you know, the graphical part is almost illusory. But the difference is, of course, you're not going to, like, original music or anything. So the main way that you're going to anticipate what's going to happen is just by looking at the far side of the screen, the right-hand side. That's, it kind of reminds me when I was learning to drive, that my driving instructor would say, you've got to look farther down the road, because if you're looking there, that's already happened by the time you react to it. So, you know, that's pretty much what you're dealing with here. You don't really want to be looking at your character very often, because you need to be looking at that far side of the screen so you can anticipate what's going to happen. And I guess the point where it really gets sticky is, like, so you start off and you get these short levels, which, you know, perfectly sort of manageable, really, because it doesn't take long to learn them, and, you know, it's reasonable that you won't make a mistake after a little practice in that span of time. But then you get, like, Neil has talked about this on the newscast and stuff, it seems like it's a pretty infamous level already, relatively, is 1-11, so there's three worlds, so this is, you know, almost a third of the way into the game at this point. But it's a preceding a boss level, and it is very, very long, much longer than the other ones are, which, in absolute terms, is still only a few minutes, but when the margin of error is what it is here, it's a long time. And also, in addition to it being a lot longer, they dial up the precision required. You'll start off and you just say, okay, there's some sort of obstacle in the middle on the flat plane and you've got to jump over it. Well, then in this level, they start introducing the idea of, well, you need to jump over it, but in such a way that you come down very close to it. In other words, you're going early, you know? You're going earlier than you were before, otherwise you won't be able to dodge the next obstacle. You know, they're chaining things together. And so this double whammy of simultaneously increasing the precision but lengthening out the period of time in which you have to avoid making a single mistake is a difficulty spike of the highest order. It really does hit you hard. And so that was testing. And then you kind of get through that, you do the boss level, which kind of takes quite a while. And then once you get to the second world, it kind of goes back to the short levels again until you get towards the end of that world. And then you get another, couple of long levels before the boss, and then the same for the final world. So those long levels are really kind of arduous.
It's weird because they added checkpoints in Void. I mean, in the first two games in the series, in the Bit Trip series, everybody said these games are really hard. They need checkpoints. And the developer,
that's a logical move.
Right. And the developer said, okay, we hear you, but it's going to be the third game before we can get it in early enough in the development schedule.
Yeah.
I remember reading that in interviews. And so the guys at Gaijin Games, they put it into the third game, Void. And those checkpoints help a lot, and they make that game a lot more playable. And I'm sure the people who bought it saw more of it than they saw of the first two games. And I wonder, being that the checkpoints aren't in Runner, it makes me wonder if Runner was in simultaneous development with Void, because it's a more complex game, graphically and musically.
It's more ambitious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, well, certainly not out of the question, but the way I feel about it really is just that the majority of the levels are of a length that is suitable, that is commensurate with the expectation you would have of someone being able to execute a certain section, essentially sort of do all the right actions at the right time for a relatively short period
memorize
of time.
Memorize the pattern, basically.
Memorize the pattern, or, to some extent, you can anticipate these things to a certain extent, because what will happen is they kind of set up these sequences that will repeat. So they're almost like little phrases, if you will. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like a little phrase that they'll repeat again. And so what will happen is, when you've seen this phrase enough times, even if you're playing a section of the level that you've never played before, if you're looking at that right side of the screen, you could say, right, it's that sequence, and you know what to do, even though you've not played that literal part of the level before. You can anticipate and you can do it. But here's the problem. When you get into the really long levels that like that, you've got a problem of fatigue. And fatigue is the real enemy with this, because if you get tired, you get sloppy. And that what will happen is that you'll start messing up stuff that you were doing perfectly a few tries ago, because it just kind of wears you down. And then you get more frustrated, because now you're not even getting to the bit you're actually stuck on.
It's so old school.
that is very, very old school. And I think that's the thing. See, where they think they went wrong is they kind of say, okay, we're going to have all these little short levels that are not too painful, and that's going to kind of introduce you to these little sequences of obstacles that we've got, these little phrases. And then we're going to have a longer level, so, okay, now here's the challenge. We're going to put all of the phrases in there, almost like, Rhythm Tengoku remix stage that they have at the end of a sequence of games in Rhythm Tengoku, which is longer and it incorporates the ones that came before it. I think they will go for a similar thing. But the problem is, when you make it that long and you have the level of precision that's required here, and you can't make a single mistake, it's just not balanced.
Deadly combination.
I mean, if you want to leverage the gameplay on that kind of pattern recognition, where the player is learning the sequences in the small stage and applying that knowledge in the longer stage, the best thing to do may have been just to loosen the timing up a little bit. But when you put the two together, at least for someone of my ability playing this game, that was a bit much.
Yeah, and I'm going to venture to say that your ability at the game is above average.
I don't. I've certainly got a lot of patience this kind of thing.
You beat it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I have all three of the previous Bit Trip games. I haven't beaten any of them.
Patience is probably the most important ability here, rather than your actual timing. Because, I mean, the thing is, I will say, when you are playing a section of the game that you've not played before, like maybe you've been stuck at something and you've been trying and trying and trying, and then you get past it, and then you're into the great unknown, and you anticipate stuff and you get it right, and you get to the end, that is exhilarating, you know, because it's so rare in a game these days. You have those kind of stakes, the feeling of like, I do not want to be trying the same thing for another 50 times to get back to this point, just to learn this stuff again. If I can nail it the first time, that's cathartic, you know, it's awesome. So, you know, that is really exhilarating. The problem is it doesn't really happen that often, or it didn't for me. I just wasn't good enough. You know, maybe it happened for a little while, but then especially with these long levels, eventually, you know, they just throw something at you that's really difficult to see coming. You know, I mean, it's possible, but it would have been, you know, you'd have to be really good, and it's just a lot easier to end up memorizing it and then just practicing it. Like I said, being patient is probably what's going to be the key factor in getting you to beat it after a while. But yeah, you know, that satisfaction, especially in the shorter levels, does come more often, and they are the majority of what is, you know, not a huge game, but I suppose, you know, kind of appropriate for its content. I mean, I guess one thing I would say, I'm not as enamored with the audiovisual stuff as everyone else seems to be. It's good. There's been a lot of very strong praise for it, and it's just, you know, it's not as vibrant as perhaps I was expecting. I don't know, maybe my expectations were a little high, but you know, sometimes in certain situations, like, you know, it's just some of it's related to your performance, because you gain these particular sort of score items.
Oh yeah, when I played it at PAX East, and when I got the Rainbow Trail, I just cracked a big smile. Because it's so goofy. It's so 80s.
Well, the more items you get of those particular items, what happens is your trail sort of gets more colourful and more instruments come in. And like, but if you're playing certain sections of the game where you won't get one of those for ages, it's just kind of monotonous. And if you keep failing a section like that, it's monotonous for a long time. But, you know, when it builds, like, it definitely does, there is that kind of sensation of, like, even though you're not going faster, it feels like you are, because more, there's more instruments, it's more intense. It does work, it's just not quite where I was thinking perhaps it would be from some of the stuff I read, but it's still a satisfying part of the experience. And I'd say, I mean, you know, if you're someone who likes the old school kind of trial and error kind of stuff, it is satisfying. It will give you something that, you know, not much new stuff is going to give you. But I would say sometimes it feels a little bit of a kind of one note and a bit of a mechanical kind of experience, you know.
This all sounds very familiar to anybody who's played the other BitTrip games. I mean, they all have the same
it
pros
really, really
and cons,
does.
Basically.
Well, I mean, like a sort of more traditional kind of platform game, there really isn't any way of expressing yourself in the gameplay. I mean, the only real thing in there is you've got the gold bars, which is kind of like a tiers of difficulty kind of thing, because it's, you know, to get all the gold bars, you're gonna have to be even more precise with,
right,
your,
I mean,
with your timing.
Just the level we played at PAX East was probably, what, the first level?
No, I think it was a little farther in than that.
Okay, because I felt like I couldn't even get them all, even if I went back a few times, and like, I was just like, screw it, I'm not going to get it. I'm going to lose if I get it.
Yeah, exactly. It's more risky, you know, and it's inviting you to kind of maybe take a riskier path. Sometimes it kind of forks off a little bit, like a high path and a low path. And so you can, if you just want to get past the level and see the next one, you know, you could say, screw the gold bars, I'm not going for them because it's too risky, it's too much to ask. But, you know, at the same time, if you want to get like a better score, which there aren't score tables, so that's kind of a downside on that. Sorry, there's not online score tables. Yeah. It obviously does save your score, but you do get like an indicator if you collect all the bars, but I'm not sure there's any kind of real incentive scheme for it. I mean, they mentioned something about going to their website for something about proof of collecting all the bars and the retro challenge bars as well in all the levels, which would be incredibly difficult, but I don't know, maybe they're going to send out like a patch or something, like really old school. Because it is just like, go to their website, it isn't built into the game at all or anything, it doesn't look like there's any unlockables or anything like that.
Show us a Polaroid of your achievement, we'll send you a patch to sew into your bag.
That's the best.
Okay, well, we are going to have to wrap up new business and take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about our E3 predictions and have a little preview. That's going to be fun. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. All right, this week at NWR, we've got two new features, including Deal Machine. This is something new that James put together. It automatically finds the best deals on new Wii games under 20 bucks. It's really funny, and it can help you save some money. Nice job, James.
Thanks. I basically just make fun of the game, so enjoy that.
Yeah, even the good ones.
They're all good.
The other really interesting new feature this week is Nintendo History 101 from Pedro Hernandez. Pedro, by the way, is a licensed educator, so it makes sense that he would try to get you some learning on. And this debut entry is called Donkey Kong versus King Kong, and it's about the whole famous 1980s court scene with Nintendo versus MCA Universal over the alleged copyright infringement of Donkey Kong on the King Kong character. Pretty interesting stuff, actually.
On the news front, Matt Blunden has a report on PokéPark Wii Pikachu's Adventure that'll be coming to Europe this year for some reason.
Because we don't want it here?
Just in existence, in general. Neil has his next entry in the Extra Life feature, which he covers Ninja Town. It's an adorable tower defense game.
Yes, he seemed to like it. So does everybody else who plays it. So,
good game.
Don't be quick to judge, sir.
That's the point of the feature. In other news, Etrian Odyssey 3 will be released by Atlus in North America. It's incredibly long and soul-crushingly difficult, so I look forward to James' tortured rants in the coming months.
To be fair, I won't be able to find one of the 5 copies made of it.
We also have word on Sega's next Sonic game for Wii and DS, which will be called Sonic Colors. It takes place in an outer space theme park and has a terrible name.
Sonic Colors, that title blows my mind.
Over in reviews, Neil's got himself a review of Prince of Persia: The Forgotten Sands, which is actually slightly Wii exclusive. There's Wii exclusive features. He claims that it does not reinvent the wheel, but it is coming from a strong background, so it doesn't really have to reinvent the wheel. And then we also have another review from Matt Blunden of FIFA 10 Road to the World Cup. This version is not on Facebook. He praises the Wii's pointer controls and smooth online play, but says there isn't much new content for the previous FIFA owners.
Not long now, a couple of weeks away from war between our two countries.
There we go.
Once again.
Yeah, every 4 years I get really excited about not watching the World Cup. All right, so you can see and read and hear all of this great content at the site, in addition to Andy's own review of Picross 3D, which he talked about on the newscast. He'll plug that later. Thanks. Check it out. Okay, we are back for an E3 prediction segment here. Greg has put together typically awesome notes for this, and so since he did all the preparation work, I'm going to let him guide us through this. And I should note that we will probably revisit this topic, and I can almost guarantee we'll revisit this topic in some way next week, because John will be back. We might even have a special guest, another special guest next week, to talk about some of this stuff. So this won't be the last you hear before E3 of us talking about E3.
This is part one, let's call it, of E3 2010 preview. So just to remind, by the time this episode goes out, it'll be just around about 2 weeks away, just a little bit over. And Nintendo's media brief will be on Tuesday, June the 15th. At 9 a.m. Pacific time. As usual, we'll expect Reggie to get up there and, you know, give us the good news from up on the mountaintop.
A lot of charts.
Well, yeah, that's the good news for them. Yeah. They don't really need to tell us that, to be honest.
We made a lot of money.
But they usually do. So the first thing that I want to concentrate on, obviously, we have done predictions at the start of the year, some of which for some of us came true, and other people like James thought Galaxy was coming out 6 months from now. But one of the things...
Look, it might still be for Europe. You don't know, man.
The volcano might erupt again and cut off all the copies. We won't get it until Christmas. But the one thing none of us saw coming was the 3DS. Yeah. Any of us thought that we'd be looking at a full-on blowout reveal of a new Nintendo handheld at E3, but that is exactly what we're looking at.
Well, I thought we might see a new handheld at E3, but I didn't think it would be 3D.
Well, that's true. Well, I think we've generally talked about maybe, they'd reveal it in Japan at the end of the year.
I thought that was more likely.
To avoid intruding on a sort of last hurrah holiday season for DS in the West, which, because it's still selling really well.
And they just put out the XL, for God's sakes. I mean, just.
Yeah, exactly. But as it happens, we already know that the 3DS is going to be a huge part of Nintendo's presentation. So I guess the first thing is just the real basics. When is it going to come out, and how much is it going to cost?
I don't think it'll be out in America by the end of the year.
You don't?
I think that would really be Nintendo kind of burning money, because they can easily have a really, really big Christmas with DS, and they're going to alienate some of those people. I mean, I guess there's a possibility they could do a combo where they could cut the price on the DS and launch the 3DS, and that way they'll kind of eliminate crosstalk between those two markets. Because I think DSLs are slowing down, even though they launched the XL. If you notice, the sales of DS dropped pretty significantly from April to May, or from March to April, I should say. And that's, after the XL came out. So I think there was a big
bump.
Yeah, there was a bump of people who wanted to buy the XL, and that's over. They can certainly still sell a bunch of DSs at Christmas, and maybe they can do that even if they launch the 3DS too. But I have a feeling that the software won't be there to justify launching the system.
Well, I'm not sure it was in 2004 either, though. They launched the DS to a pretty meager lineup.
Andy brings up a very important point, the parallel with the DS launch. But of course, the circumstances were different. It certainly seemed Nintendo was a little more scared of Sony perhaps coming into the portable
Fair
market.
Enough.
Well, and DS launched in America first. And that will not happen with 3DS, I can guarantee you.
Well, certainly that would go against the pattern that we've seen with everything else, where it's Japan first, because the DS took off on its rise to heaven.
Japan needs the 3DS a lot sooner than America does.
It does.
More acutely, definitely. So, James, do you agree with what Jolly's saying here, that we'll get the big blowout, but they're going to tell us it's coming out in 2011?
I wouldn't be surprised if there is a... Where is that? There will be a reveal of the DS, 3DS rather, at E3, obviously. I mean, they have to. They are mandated by both business concerns and basically management of the media and management of message that they have to do a noteworthy reveal at E3.
It could be kind of a tease, though, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of feeling like they'll talk about it. Reggie will probably pull one out of a pocket and be like, look at this.
Yeah.
Look at this thing.
Oh, he definitely will pull it out of his pocket.
And then, Iwata will make a stilted joke about it, and that might be all we get out of it.
Well, think about it this way. Haven't they already said that it's coming out before the end of 2010 fiscal year?
We already know that it's coming out in the fiscal year.
Right.
How long has it been since they launched a new piece of hardware not in the holiday season?
DSi and DSi XL.
Well, see, here's where I put it. I put it squarely in March of 2011.
So you say right at the end of...
Right at the end of the fiscal year, because they'll be able to say...
I agree.
Next year. And you know what? There's precedent for that, because when did the DS come out in Europe?
It came out in that February, maybe, 2005?
March 2005.
Yeah, so
I can totally see them dropping it in March, because it won't...
GBASP was the same way. I mean, it launched in, I think, January in Japan, and March or April in the U.S., This has happened before.
There's a couple reasons for this. One, it won't cannibalize the holiday sales, but it also won't cannibalize that golden month that comes after the holidays, people spending their money. You put it near at the end of the fiscal year, so you can lead off with it in terms of pretty much the entire year from that point on. So all your R&D costs are mitigated back in previous years. So going forward, it's profit from these
guys.
It's
an accounting trick.
Yeah.
They do it all the time.
Yeah.
Everybody does.
Why the fiscal year is such an important sort of definition, why they set that as a benchmark.
Yeah.
But the primary reason I don't think it would be a holiday, I mean, I'll know if it's coming out this year if we can see their booth on the Monday before the show opens. Because if it's got a big footprint there, it's coming out in November. If it doesn't, it's coming out in March. Like, we won't even need to make it to their press conference to know if we can get that quick look, because that'll tell us everything we need to know about it.
So, James, are you looking at, like, a kind of a revolution situation, like in E3 2005 when they announced the revolution and they showed it, and I got to touch one, you know.
But did it excite you?
But, well, it did, but it was very hard to get up to that VIP room where they had the actual models.
Right.
So there were no games, no controller, no graphics.
It was TGS where everything got kind of blown out.
And, well, not even really then. They showed the controller at TGS that year.
But let's not forget that particular, the E3 2005, nearly 18 months away from the Wii's launch. That's right. Assuming they're true to their word, we're nowhere near that far away from...
See, I don't think it would be that constrained either. I think there will be units there. They might have them in the back room for demo. Mm-hmm. This is the March theory, how the March theory plays out. The March theory plays out is they will be invite-only experience with the units. They will be in the LA Convention Center or in a hotel nearby.
But it'll be like a really limited quantity.
Yes.
So there won't be a line of people all over E3 trying to play the 3DS.
Right. Well, and the hype machine that Nintendo hopes to build with their platform, i.e. their booth,
will be Zelda.
With Zelda, and they can try to continue to keep DS as a focal point of their message, even though they're showing the 3DS to members of the media. If it's coming out this year, the DS is going to be on a back wall, because it's going to get backwatered immediately.
See, I don't think Nintendo can successfully make DS or DSi or DSi XL a really major part of their presentation this year, because I don't think they have the software to back it up.
They
didn't last year.
But is this not the key question, Johnny? You came, you earlier on said you don't think that you didn't think the software would be there to sort of float a holiday launch yet for 3DS.
Yeah.
But here's the question: is it perhaps possible that some of the lighter showings on DS in recent times have been reflective of the fact that they've been, you know, preparing this for
hoarding
a while, and that they've fact because the DS has been so successful and they haven't been pressured by the looming threat of Sony coming into the market the way they were with the DS in 2004, that they've actually got, you know, they are ready with a much more robust lineup of games for 3DS than was the case in 2004. Is that you know, feasible to your mind?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
I think it's also possible that they just haven't felt they needed to develop these games, and they were just willing to let third parties go out there and just take the benefit of the license fees.
Yeah, but I mean, what we're saying is the teams at Nintendo were working on something.
Right.
So they were working on 3DS games. And I guess I'm more concerned about the third-party situation, because I think if 3DS launches at the end of this calendar year in any territory, and honestly, I think that's very unlikely, because I think that 3DS will probably launch nearly simultaneously, at least between Japan and North America, which tells me it's going to be in January through March.
I think the big three markets will get it all about the same time.
Well, Europe, maybe not.
Who knows? I mean,
within a quarter.
Recently, it's certainly Europe and America have been relatively harmonized with the DS iterations,
right,
but this is different. I mean, this is a different generation.
I would say that it would be Japan as a lead market, but not by much. And then
Japan, it needs it the most.
It would be Europe and North America pretty much at the same time, and then maybe some of the smaller markets get it in the months following that.
One of the things that I'm thinking is, alongside the Wii, one of the things the 3DS is going to have sort of as a factor is it's one of those things that you're not going to be able to really put up on a screen and demonstrate why it's different. So I guess what I'm saying is at some point they've got to have some sort of press demo where people can come from the press and put their hands on it to get the word out.
Absolutely.
Well, if it's not E3, then they've got to have another event. If you weren't going to go really big
with this, when is the better opportunity to get the train going?
They can always stage their own events. They've done it before. Before the Wii came out, they flew a bunch of people out to New York to do some crazy event in like a warehouse.
Well, they've had the Fall Media Summit. I mean, the DSi was the fault was out of the Fall Media Summit, if I'm not mistaken.
They do that stuff.
And the Wii experience is going to inform them a lot, because I'm sure they're going to be like, okay, not just in terms of getting it in the hands of journalists, but getting it in the hands of, you know, bloggers or whatever. It's kind of
mommy bloggers.
These network-based marketing strategies that they've got these days, they're going to be looking at that on a longer sort of haul, a longer term strategy. But this is, for me, is definitely where it starts, whether it's coming out in March or October, as there have been some actually out
no
of
way.
Europe, there were rumors of an October launch, which I would find surprising.
No, I mean, because they've got three games coming out this year that I know of that are first party or second party, and that would literally set all of those games on fire.
Well, but you see, this is the thing. We got, obviously, as I said, the circumstances with the DS were different. I'm sure they felt more pressured and everything.
Oh yeah,
and you know, they did certain strange things. Like, of course, like, for instance, Minish Cap, you know, that was pushed out of the holiday launch window in America,
right,
because the DS was first, and so Europe got Minish Cap and then the DS afterwards, so they kind of flipped that around and things like that. So they were worried about cannibalization then and all this sort of stuff, but of course we're in a different circumstance now.
It's kind
they
of
have...
funny though, because there was no software on the DS when it came out.
No, well, there wasn't, but I suppose just if you bought one, that was a lot of your gaming you know, expenditure just down right there and then. But I mean, with this situation now, you do have, you know, the broader audiences, you know, they probably feel like they're not just selling 3DS to the people that would buy DS games or DS hardware necessarily. Certainly DS hardware, they're selling it to a different group at this
right.
point, you know, it would seem. And so some of that, I think, you know, is going to be on price in terms of the differentiating these markets. And my feeling would be, this has got, I can't go over $200.
I agree.
That cannot happen.
No,
but on
I
the
think...
other hand, on the basis that the DSi XL is already 180, is
that's
that, or is it 90?
That's a specialty product.
But even DSi is 170, is it not?
Yeah, and that, well, that's going to be cut.
I think this is probably is going to be 199.
Yeah,
I feel.
Yeah, yeah, that's
maybe
that's
DSi comes down to 150 or lower. But that, I think that's pretty much, you know, what you're going to be looking at. They're going to say, okay, we're going to have 3DS. Whenever it comes out, it's going to be early adopter kind of market. I think they're going to launch with stuff that appeals to the Nintendo fan base to get it going. And I go back, this was something I mentioned in the prediction show. I think they are going to have a portable VC early to get
early.
People on that, or at least the promise of one to get Nintendo fans on that tray. Because you talk
one
about
day.
Software, that's an easy way.
It's
to get
built-in library, right?
To get the faithful excited about getting one early, you know, that these are games they already know they like.
Right.
And so that does you another benefit, because if the starting lineup for these games is light, which we expect it probably will be based on our experience with Nintendo, i.e. every system they've released since the N64, a built-in virtual console
so Super
at the start,
Nintendo had a pretty thin launch, too.
That's true, it did.
I mean, it was good, but thin.
The Game Boy Color had a bunch of ports from the original Game Boy.
Yeah, system launch lineups are never good.
No.
You're lucky if there's, like, one or two good games in there, but the lineup overall is never good at launch.
I'd venture the Super Nintendo one was actually pretty spectacular, if small, compared to most. You know, I mean, think of like Mario World, F-Zero, Pilot Wings. I mean, it's a lot better than what you normally get.
The DS one was particularly painful, because the first...
Awesome.
Well, the marquee title was an N64 port.
And the secondary title was a bad touchscreen game from Sega.
Yeah,
I mean, that's...
Feel the Magic.
So, well, let's pull it to software then. Regardless of when it's specifically going to come out, Andy... what do you think? What kind of software are they going to let? I mean, do you go along with me, say it's going to be aimed at the Nintendo faithful, or will we see, you know, expanded audience kind of stuff with it?
Oh, I expect we'll see a little bit of both. I'm not sure they're ready to throw all of their eggs into either basket, so to speak. I think we'll probably see a new Brain Age. I'm not sure if it'll be 3D or not, but I expect it's been a long time since we've seen a Brain Age. That's a pretty...
Well, it has, but it hasn't, because they released that weird downloadable mix-up thing.
Yeah, they're just pieces of it. Yeah.
How many people in the Brain Age market are actually downloading DSiWare games, though, really?
Well, it says it actually comes preloaded with some DSIs and stuff.
Oh, yeah,
like
that's true.
So,
I forgot about
that.
I feel they'll probably have some sort of a gamer's hardcore faithful title on game on there, but I don't know if it'll be anything all that dramatic. I mean, they haven't made that many first party gamer games on the DS to begin with. Like Zelda is, you know, maybe like a Fire Emblem game here and there, but those are kind of, you know, few and far between.
I've got a whole shelf of them. I mean, what are you talking about?
I'm going to make a big, bold prediction here. I think 3DS could launch with a new Super Mario Brothers.
I would believe it, but I'm not sure how 3D would work out well.
That is a game that is relatively easy to make, if only because it's familiar. But it gives them a way. I mean, you think back to Wario Land on Virtual Boy. It's not that hard to integrate some kind of 3D depth perception element into a 2D side-scrolling platform.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing about that game is its gimmick is that it's a traditional 2D side-scrolling game.
Yeah.
But you can have that while still having, like, 3D visual effects.
Yes.
I guess.
It's easy, and it's popular, and it's something that both the traditional, you know, the core Nintendo audience wants, and the larger audience wants.
It would certainly resurrect that question of Mario saturation that we were discussing earlier.
Oh no, it would answer that question. Even the most hardcore Nintendo apologists wouldn't be able to reject that theory anymore.
Do you guys expect that the media will change? I mean, I know it's backwards compatible with DS, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So either they're going to ship these new games, which could potentially be much, you know, much more visually impressive on the DS carts, or they're going
to
have
There is going to be a media change. Piracy, you know, they're going to make changes in that area because they are undoubtedly, maybe they overstated in the media somewhat, but there's no doubt they are very angry with what's happened on DS with just the relative ease of piracy. They can't stop it,
But they don't necessarily have to change the physical structure of the media to deal with the piracy.
It could be the online aspect potentially could help with that, but I think there will be different media as well.
It won't be a disc, I can tell you that.
No way in hell.
Coming back to this idea, if you like, new Super Mario Brothers, is it good because it, you know, what use are the 3D effects? I mean, do you really think that the 3D effects is going to be such a huge component of these games when it is optional? You can switch off the 3D display.
They named the system the 3DS.
Well, they haven't named it that yet, though.
Well, that's what they've been referring to it as.
But it's at this point, it's still in the code name, kind of territory. It's not necessarily
I realize that, but I mean, they could have called it whatever they wanted. I mean, the thing's not losing the DS brand. I mean, it just isn't. It'd be moronic.
I would be really shocked if it was called the 3DS in the end. That seems like, I don't know, that seems very much to me a working title.
I fully expect it to stick. I think it'll be called 3DS.
But whether it's the name of the system or not, and obviously that is important in terms of creating perceptions, but like I said, this is, you know, an optional effect. You could turn this display off.
Yeah, it's an enhancement.
When you're talking about the sort of, you know, the experiences that are going to define this system in the early going, is it really going to be so much about it being 3D, or is you don't think, I mean, there's obviously a lot of things we don't know about the hardware at this point.
Here's the thing. If you have to go back to the original DS games, those first ones, where it was like, we have to push the touchscreen even when it shouldn't be used here.
But here's the point. If you go back to this point in the DS display, we didn't even know it had a touchscreen.
Right.
So if we were doing this show, then we would have had to say they're going to push the dual screen.
It was rumored.
We weren't supposed to know it does 3D now either. You've got to remember, that came out because it was about to get leaked.
Yeah. Well, because it was that time. But what I'm saying is that my feeling is given that this is an optional effect, it doesn't seem likely to me that this will be the be-all and end-all of. You know, when they talk about they've launched a new system or a new generation of systems when it's about giving us a new experience, I think the 3D, I think we've expressed this before, is going to be a part of that.
First off, that's lip service, because launching a new system is really about giving them a new revenue stream.
Yeah,
not not giving us a new experience. They're going to make it new enough for us that we take notice of it. And as trite as the 3D visual effect might be, and as optional as it might be, it is very attention grabbing, especially being that it's going to be an affordable package and that you won't have to wear glasses. And that will be easily enough to get the public on board. Now, the real substantive upgrade that we're getting here is probably just more hardware, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be faster. It's going to have better graphics. It'll be able to do a lot more polygons. But that's not very easy to sell to the public, especially when you've had PSP for the past 4 years.
So let's bring it right. If you've got that headline thing, okay, it's like this is the difference to the mainstream media or whatever, is that it could do 3D. How does that feed into what they decide to launch the system with. You know, are they really going to be stuff that's at least under the pretense that you could only do this with
see,
something
that's
with scary as copy 3D?
I don't think New Super Mario Bros. Wii is the answer, or New Super Mario Bros. 3DS is the answer here. See, it's double pun because it's the third New Super Mario Bros.
Yeah.
Which that game will come out because Nintendo loves puns. They'll make it just for that pun. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I don't think that'll be the game is because I feel like they would want to put out a game where the gameplay emphasizes the 3D elements, if only so they can bring it on the Today Show and be like, you can't see this game's great, but because it's in 3D, it makes playing it more fun.
You see, I think, and James, I know you've played Wario Land on Virtual Boy. I think that is exactly the kind of game to show off the system for the first time, because it's something that everybody understands, and it's something that works even if you turn off the 3D effect. You've still got two layers of depth. It's basically parallax, right? I mean, it's being translated to the player through multiple ways, because, you know, Mario goes back into the background or whatever, or he comes out to the foreground, and his size changes, and
right.
You know, there's this transition animation so that you see that he's moving to a different level of depth. That will work whether you've got the 3D effect turned on or off, but if you turn it on, it's more convincing.
And I think that it fulfills the role that I see of having a situation where, because it's an optional effect and just because of, you know, what stereoscopic 3D does or doesn't give you in a game experience, that it has the pretense that it's just something you couldn't do before, when clearly it is, but it's just kind of makes more sense. It's just more intuitive this way.
Yeah, well, they even do that in Paper Mario.
Yeah, exactly. But the idea that, you know, you kind of really see that change. Yeah,
it just looks cooler now.
See, the reason that I struggle with that is I'm looking at the Nintendo model of the Wii, which is, this is, the game they showed for the Wii was Wii Sports. Mm-hmm. The game that they trotted out 2 years ago now, I guess, was Wii Sports Resort. I feel like they know how to sell these expanded market hardware games now. And
James, this is apples and oranges. I mean, that's Wii. We're talking about the successor to DS now. DS is already hugely popular. And you know the games that people play on their DS? It's Mario and Mario Kart. I mean, they sold a lot of Brain Age, but how much Brain Age is actually being played? Not that much.
And also, like I said, if you're starting at a point, you know, if it's got a $200 price point, you know, that's console level. So, you know, this is kind of like a premium product right now.
For the time being.
The thing about Mario games, it gets you started well in any camp. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about it.
It just seems to me that they have to justify the decision to make, not just make a new system, but to make it a 3D system. And I feel like beyond just saying, look, you can jump between levels, they could do something that's much more, I don't use the word casual because that's become almost a four-letter word.
You're expecting something more experimental.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm expecting them to bring out something that's we're like...
I think they don't have to. I think that's it's unnecessary for them to do something really weird like that.
My question is, the expanded market, we don't know that that's a market that's necessarily going to be easily convinced to buy another system. You have to convince them to buy another DS, and they're going to tell you, I already have a DS.
Well, precisely, moreover, these people in the expanded audience sort of sector didn't buy their DS in 2005.
Right.
They probably bought it in 2008, 2009, whatever. You know, it's very much less likely that you're going to hit them early. You know, you got to pick your battles to some extent. And so I certainly don't expect them to ignore that. But relatively, the emphasis is going to be more on, you know, your kind of early adopter game enthusiasts.
Well, see, if you're going to do that, I think you go something that's much more focused, and I think you bring out something that's maybe not necessarily a new Super Mario Bros. Game, since we just freaking got one of those.
Yeah, that is, it is hard to imagine.
I think it'd be something that's even less, if you're going to say you're going after the early adopters, you go with something that's less leveraged on the wide appeal, and you bring out
Star Fox?
Yes. That you actually finished my sentence before I could get there.
That would be great.
That, yeah. If they're going after the core audience, it would be something like Star Fox, not something like New Super Mario Brothers, because we just got that.
Yeah.
If they're going to go after an expanded audience, it's going to be something more experimental on the Wii Sports vein. I don't feel like that middle ground is what they're going to hit on the first pass. They're going to want to hit that after the base is already
clearly
established.
Clearly, something like that is going to happen. The question is it going to happen at launch? You know,
right.
I feel like Star Fox meets both those goals, though. One, it gets the base. They wet themselves. They literally will wet themselves in the seats when it's announced. But But more importantly, you can trot that game out at non-gamer events and say, look how 3D makes this better.
Sure. It is Nintendo's. It was Nintendo's first polygonal game, so I mean, it would
It kind of works on that tech demo level for people who are not invested in the game, but
right.
then
so
there
even
are
it,
people
even
that are
people
invested
who are
in
that expanded audience would say, whoa, that's 3D on a handheld versus, well, he's jumping between levels. Great.
yeah, well, I mean, it's going to be, look, I believe we're going to have a significantly more broad lineup than we had for the DS in 2004. So I think we will actually see a number of different kinds of experiences. They're going to try and hit a number of bases. But at the same time, there is a limit to this 3D, you know, what it's going to give you, to be honest.
Right,
I mean, you know, you're going to hit the walls of that pretty quickly. In terms of, I think there will be things that will impress people when they have it in their hands. Very much the first impression kind of thing. But in the end, you know, I think the game experiences in terms of getting people to buy the system are going to have to justify themselves rather than just justify the 3D part of it.
I think the more interesting hardware feature that will be announced is that, and Iwata's already alluded to this, but it will probably have a persistent online connection through some kind of mobile connection. Maybe it's 3G, you know, similar. He's talked about liking the way it's done on Kindle, and I think having a free, you know, it's not free, it's built into the price of the system, which again makes sense at the $200 price point. But the amount of actual bandwidth that they're going to have to, you know, that's going to have to be subsidized through that seems kind of low, especially early on. So I think they can get away with that, and they'll get sweetheart deals from Verizon or whoever they do it with. But I think that opens up a lot of service possibilities for Nintendo, because then they can even charge for a handheld online gaming service potentially. Whereas like with DS, you can't imagine. I mean, people don't play their DS online enough to even imagine that would be a smart thing
to do. Well, and they did make a comment to that extent relatively recently that they in the future might charge for.
Yeah, Miyamoto was hinting at the idea of a premium sort of service, sort of like what Sony have started to talk about. You know, that there would be a baseline service that remains free at the point of use, but there would be a plus service that gets you in there. So.
And that makes no sense for DS if you have to search for hotspots. But if you have a persistent connection, then what they can do is say, well, you know, for free, you can access the 3DS shop and download games, the virtual handheld service or whatever. You can check that, you can use it as a web browser, but if you pay, you can play Mario Kart online.
What about the idea of actually different, you know, SKUs, a 3G SKU, for instance?
The iPad strategy?
Pre-fragmented audience?
It seems counter to Nintendo's approach to me, that they typically, I found the DSi quite shocking in terms of the segment in the market thing.
Yeah. I think they're willing to do that with the DSi because they always viewed it as kind of a... Yeah, temporary thing.
Well, they had nothing to lose by the time they launched DSi.
See, I don't think they'd want to do that with 3DS, or if we're not all calling
not
it that.
Not at launch.
I don't think they'd want to do that ever again. I think it really screwed them over on the DSi, because DSiWare can now only be bought by a small portion of their audience.
Yeah, they don't really care though.
No, they don't. They don't care.
They don't care about DSiWare anyway.
Well, I mean, Andy, what do you think about if they go to this situation where you're going to have a persistent online connection or that? Do you see DSiWare, if it's still called that or whatever, or however much it kind of carries over the previous games we've already got, is going to be a much bigger part of their strategy at that point? That maybe, you know, we won't have the same kind of really restrictive file sizes, and they might actually put, you know, some major franchise games out digitally as part of a move against piracy and whatnot?
Well, it's not only a move against piracy, it's also a move against Apple.
Retailers as well. I mean, you're cutting them out of the profit pie.
Whether or not Nintendo likes it, a lot of people are becoming aware that you can take a mobile device and download lots and lots of content to that device. Nintendo can't afford to just ignore that forever. And they've come out and said as much that, you know, Apple is the future of their competition.
Right.
They've said that a couple of different times, actually, I think.
And again, they can't really compete if the only time you can buy things on your 3DS is when you're around a hotspot that you happen to have security access to. And by the way, in terms of piracy, if it has a persistent 3G connection, they can do DRM checks without really pissing people off, because you don't really care if your handheld checks in.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all good arguments about, you know, competing with Apple, cutting the retailers. Although Nintendo's got a good relationship with retail, it's not going to sour overnight, but they're going to kind of, I think there's going to be a drift there where they'll gradually create more and more of their revenue without the retailers being involved. But all these arguments are good, but the sealer for me in terms of it having persistent online is the piracy thing. This is beginning to take shape for me.
Because the beauty of what you can do with that is if it ever gets cracked, bam, you can push out a new one and nobody will ever know it came out.
And I'm sure you're never going to put a total lid on it.
But you can keep making it hard on them. The problem with the DS
stuff is it's become so easy that it is, you know, relatively speaking, quite widespread, and they could sort of, you know, credibly claim that they are actually losing quite a lot of revenue from what you might call, you know, relatively mainstream consumers.
See, I think you run a real risk when you start doing persistent DRM with, like, the idea of taking your handheld system on a long car ride through the middle of nowhere.
Airplane mode. You know, Steam has offline mode, too, so you can play your games when you're on an airplane. All you have to do is check in with it before and then check in with it after.
I think Nintendo would have to be very careful, you know, because they're all about ease of use.
Yeah.
I think they're going to have to dance around some of the little finer points, but it does seem to me, like I said, that the weight of the piracy that just makes me that they are going to think that it will be worth their while to do that.
It's a way for them to sell their piracy protection as a useful feature to the consumer.
Yeah.
Digital, obviously, in that sense, is going to be a much bigger part. But, I mean, do you think at launch that we could see, you know, a new breed of DSiWare games? It's like, you know, there are good games on DSiWare, but none of that motivated me to buy it. I mean...
Right.
Well, I think they're going to be real hesitant to put major releases on any sort of downloadable service. And the reason, I think, is because the price for digital downloads has already been sort of established, and it doesn't meet what they're used to charging for games right now.
But what if they put it out there as a digital download and say you can get it digitally for $5 less, $10 less?
Retailers would freak out, for one.
It could be a bit early in the process for the sort of nuclear option.
I just feel like there's a it's not a $5 gap, though. When you look at something like Tiger Woods on iPhone, it's a $10 game, occasionally on sale for $5 to $10, and it's really good. Like, it is better than any golf game I've ever played on the DS, or if at least it's as good. And that's a $20 difference. DS games market at $30. I mean, that gap is not going to be closed with Nintendo saying, okay, we'll sell it to you for $5 cheaper. There's a lot
They're taking into account the fact that a large portion of their audience is probably not going to use the online service to buy the games. They're going to go to stores and buy them. I think for Nintendo, though, this would be a genius move because they get to pocket all of the money.
I don't think Nintendo will release the same titles for retail and digital distribution.
That's the really brilliant thing
about WiiWare and DSiWare is that they're separate libraries, and so the retailers can't really complain about all these art style games coming out on DSiWare because they never would have been able to sell those at retail anyway. They're not big enough.
Yeah, it's very discreet at the minute, and I suppose what I'm asking is, could we see at E3? Not retail games, you know, or retail light games, but sort of a new wave of you know, DSiWare that says something about, well, online's a lot more integral to the system, and we're sort of up in the ante somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely, I think so.
Yeah,
I think they have to. I think the new wear that they put out, 3DSware, or whatever they want to call it, it's going to have to be a pretty major selling point. I mean, I really do feel like they're going to look at the iPhone and look at what the iPhone does well and what about the iPhone is their competition. And they're going to at least have to try to mimic some of the feature set. And I think the big part of that is the App Store. I think they're going to try to make a concerted effort to make the online digital sales a bigger part of the platform.
And they automatically will be if it's online all the time.
Absolutely.
That's automatically easier to buy that stuff, even if the same number of games come out. And they already have a pretty large library of DSiWare. It's never going to be like iPhone because it's not open.
No.
Right, well, let's move on a little bit with the handheld stuff. Just in terms of third parties, how much do we expect, what kind of enthusiasm do we think they might or might not embrace the 3DS with at this stage?
Oh, they're ready.
I'd love to see a new 2D Castlevania.
You mean 3D?
You mean
well,
2D
with 3D. 2D with 3D effects. A different version of 2.5D, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, the new 2.5D. Yeah.
You know, we're going to get the same stuff that we always get when third parties get on a new system, which is, generally speaking, Ubisoft's going to release 30 games and all of them will be shit. But it's just kind of that starting point where they're like, well, they embrace it early because they feel like, well, there won't be a lot of competition.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. We might call it the Red Steel effect at this point.
Red Steel 3DS.
It sold 1 million copies on the basis that it was on sale.
Yes.
At a particular time.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I think we will see certain publishers that are willing to dip their toes in.
Right.
But who are you? Obviously Ubisoft, James.
But EA does the same thing when new systems come out. They release 20 games that are awful. I mean, remember, the first 360 Madden game and the first PS3 Madden game were both broken junk.
Yeah.
They were regarded as terrible games. I mean, and it's freaking Madden. I mean, for God's sake.
Sold 5 million copies. Yeah.
Exactly. It's freaking Madden, but people who buy Madden upgrade their consoles because, dude, we need to play Madden in HD now.
Well, what about on the Japanese developer side, Johnny? I mean, as you said, Japan has been in need of the 3DS for a while, so is it possible that we've got a number of Japanese publishers with some juicy titles up their sleeves for E3?
I think it's actually a harder sell for Nintendo to get Japanese developers on board with this, because you think about it, overall, America or Western companies have probably had more success on the DS than Japanese companies have. In Japan, it's been more about PSP, because again, on PSP, you don't have as much competition from Sony, first-party stuff, and PSP is a lot more successful in Japan. It's very nearly as popular as the DS is now.
Well, they sell the same week on week, sort of.
Right. The total user base is different, but
way behind. And of course, piracy is an even bigger problem on the PSP. So right. The publishers be getting hammered.
Yeah, I mean, it's bad.
They've experienced difficulties in that area. But I know what you mean. Obviously, you haven't got the sort of the looming specter of Nintendo gobbling up everyone's money on PSP. But obviously, the Japanese RPG market was really strong and for the DS and all that. I mean, mm-hmm. there was plenty of it's been good to people.
Well, that's always going to be lagging because RPGs take longer to make.
Yeah,
just,
I mean,
that's just typical.
So, but Capcom's big DS games coming out this Christmas, I don't think they're going to have anything ready.
It seems like they've got lots of DS stuff still to come. They've got Okami Den, they've got Ghost Trick.
Yeah, they've got two huge, well, relatively huge for them, DS games that are coming out at the end of the year or later.
Yeah, or next year. I mean, so, well, that raises the question, to what extent will everyone say, you know what, DS is still selling well in America in particular, still plenty of people ready to buy games in Japan. Even so, let's wait and see, and let's let Nintendo do the heavy lifting with the popularizing of the system.
Oh well, for third parties, that's out of the question in North America.
Because they already blew that with the Wii.
Well,
I mean, look, a lot of them did at least.
Third party DS games are not selling. I mean, even Ubisoft has started to slash its pets games and shit like that because they stopped. they crossed the point where that stuff was really doing well, and now the people who are now buying DS are basically just buying Mario Kart and New Super Mario Brothers. You know, they're not buying a bunch of third-party stuff. They might buy a couple of movie-licensed games or whatever, but in general, that meat market is gone. And so I think third parties will be on board with this. I mean, not with good games, necessarily. Like you said, we'll have these launch... of these launch cash-in titles, but I think they'll be very eager to get on board in the U.S. because they figure they can make a lot of money, and they're not making that much on the old DS right now, and they probably never will again.
So where does that leave us with the traditional DS and DSi at E3?
It wasn't very good last year. It's going to be worse this year.
We know Nintendo has three...
Okay, then name them. Golden Sun DS...
Golden Sun DS, the new Fire Emblem they just announced.
Which is a remake.
If that gets localized.
I still think it'll be there, though. And then the Pokemon Black and White and the Pokemon Ranger game. So that's so they've got at least three or four games that they'll have at their booth. But here's the funny thing about those games. They're all in the same freaking genre.
and by the way, Black and White will not be at E3.
I don't know. They've already shown images and video of it.
If you've seen the images and video of it, that has the look of a 3DS enhanced game to me. That has the look of a game that's going to run on your old DS. It's going to want to alienate all those people who've already got a DS and have played Soul Silver, Heart Gold, and Diamond and Pearl, and so forth. But the way they've kind of lowered the camera and the way it moves in on the battles and stuff, and the fully 3D city, that has got 3DS enhancement written all over it. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was at E3 for that reason, as one of the show-offs.
Could be.
Well, and what better property to launch a system with, seriously?
That. Well, but they're looking to have the cake and eat it, because, you know, they're going to sell it to everyone that's already got a DS. But some people might say, you know what, why don't I buy a 3DS now, because I get to play this Pokemon game that I know I want to play, but it's going to be enhanced.
The Oracle of Ages and Seasons.
Yes,
yeah,
sure.
Because, well, and also, I mean, was it not the case with Gold and Silver that they were compatible with the old Game Boy, but
they
obviously
were, yeah.
The color, there was a big part.
There was a color mode and a non-color mode, essentially. And you know what? The first game I bought with my Game Boy Color, Pokemon Silver.
Yeah, I would be astonished if in fact it wasn't a pretty significant. But obviously, they're not going to necessarily play it up as a real flagship, because it isn't an exclusive game.
No.
But it's going to be a part of the
strategy. It's going to have a big sticker on the box that says also plays on 3DS.
3DS enhanced.
So I feel like they'll show one more at their press conference, because they always announce at least one game for each system. And that won't be an RPG.
It might be DS Party.
You know what?
DS Sports.
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if there is like some kind of more casual game they announced.
Well,
DS.
They've still got the Tamagotchi collection.
That's exactly. I think they could totally do that.
That is an old game, you know, if they are really fully concentrated on 3DS.
I'm not sure that they would bring that game over now, though.
Well, we've seen some strange things. A Jam with the Band appearing in Europe in
that
two
was
years
strange.
2/5 years later or whatever. I mean, you know, you never know.
That was like the ultimate head scratching.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose we'll close out the handheld part of this. We'll just say, of the titles that you believe are going to be there already, or what we know, what are you looking forward most to getting your hands on? I mean, it's a bit of a tough question to answer, considering Johnny seems to think it's going to be so grim for the DS.
Yeah, I mean, I would say none of the above. From the things that we actually know about for sure, Golden Sun I'm kind of curious about, but, you know, I am not the biggest fan of the first one, and
yeah,
it's an RPG. I mean, it's not going to be that much fun to play at E3, so even if it turns out really well, it's not going to be a very thrilling demo.
It was a real blast of a demo last time.
Yeah.
the steps.
Exactly.
I mean, if I were going, I'd love to see Ghost Trick.
That is my game I most want to play at E3, is Ghost Trick. Really. That seems stupid, but it's true.
Well, just to see the visuals look really interesting.
It's got a hell of a pedigree to it.
You've got the Shu Takumi, the Ace Attorney stuff, and it's got the same sort of sense of humor by the looks of it.
Actually, I'll take back what I said. If Okami Den is there, that will probably be my most anticipated DS.
Which
game.
It should be.
Because
they've already showed it at Captivate.
Well, hold on. You know what else? We missed a game that's going to be at their E3 booth. Dragon Quest IX will be there, too.
Yeah. It'll be coming out, so...
It'll be coming out soon, but it'll be there, at least.
Yeah, I'll be excited to get my hands on that. But yeah, and with the knowledge that it comes out a month later.
Yeah, and...
Maybe they'll just give us all copies of it to help start the fire.
Somebody will play it.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see the next Layton, but, you know, we all think it's a very much a known quantity.
Yeah,
yeah.
So before we move on from the handheld portion of our preview, we'll have time for just some quick hits, final predictions, and bold proclamations. Andy, you first.
One thing I am predicting, although it's more wishful thinking than predicting, but I'm going to go ahead and just predict it boldly. I would like to see Club Nintendo integrated onto the DS, well, not the DS, but the 3DS and the Wii, in terms of a software update on the Wii, I suppose.
Brilliant.
Which would then finally not have your games tied to your system, mm-hmm. but tied to an account that you can manage online.
Yep.
That's my biggest want for 3DS, and it could be easily brought to Wii as well, and so I'm going to predict that for E3.
Yeah.
Well, it goes along very much with persistent online. I mean, you kind of need it, really.
Yeah.
I think, but in some way.
I mean, they have the infrastructure in place is the crazy thing. Like, they already have a way for you to create an account, and then your account becomes aware when you buy a game, so why not just bring
true.
That to the system?
It's true, but there's a lot of other stuff that they'd have to work out, too, that, I don't know. It's Nintendo.
Worth it. It's required. If you're going to do an online market, it's required, because people lose their systems and don't want to lose their software with them.
It's required. required if you're a well-rationed and sane company. We have not had 100% evidence that this is the case.
James, have you got anything that you want to go out on?
Well, I mean, I'm not thinking things are quite so dire for the DS, because I don't think we're going to... I think they learned a little bit from the GBA's extended death, where they basically kept trying to kill it effectively. I mean, I think they feel like... I think there's going to be at least one or two more major things worth of note for the DS beyond... I mean, obviously Black and White is its last biggest game.
Yeah.
But I think they'll probably have one or two more. And I still think that we're not quite ready to cross the 3DS Rubicon just yet.
Not this year. Johnny?
I will retread a little bit something I've said before on the show, but since I've already predicted Persistent Online and a Mario title for launch and showcase, I will go back to the idea that I think 3DS will have built-in accelerometers, not so much for motion control, but for motion detection, and that it will either have some kind of built-in fitness application that will be part of what James wanted, the casual, the Blue Ocean appeal.
Yeah.
That will either be built into the system, or it will be one of the launch titles that people will really want. Because it's like Wii Fit, but you always have it with you.
Would you strap it to your ass, basically?
No, it goes in your pocket or it straps to your arm. But it will be, that would be huge. That would be really smart. And when you can take your Nintendog for a walk by going on a walk.
Oh my god, if they did that, A, it would sell, and B, it would be embarrassing at the next PAX. Because the PokeWalkers did get a little embarrassing.
Of a puppy playground room at PAX.
Oh, God.
Well, I'll take my turn. I think it's coming out this year. I think it's coming out this year everywhere. What? That is my fear. I think they're going to go big this holiday season.
Go big or go home.
Yeah, I think you definitely, you're 200... Then knock the price down on the traditional DSi models, and then a Nintendo fan-centric launch lineup. Not excluded the possibility you raised, Johnny, because that's a good one. I like that. But definitely a virtual handheld, and obviously we discussed Star Fox. But could it be? Johnny used to talk about this before, well, long before the 3DS, but could Pikmin be a handheld game all of a sudden? I think the improved fidelity of the graphics that we're going to see...
Not in launch. It's not a launch kind of game.
I don't necessarily think a launch game, but I think E3 to be seen, because obviously they talked about Pikmin in that roundtable 2 years ago now. So it's long past time that we saw something out of that, and maybe this is the reason why we haven't, because it's on the hardware that's been a secret.
They've had years to make another Pikmin game, and they've sat there and dithered on it. I mean,
well, so Greg's saying Pikmin 3 is Pikmin 3D.
Oh,
maybe
no.
2011 release.
Man. That aesthetic that they've got, that zoomed in on the tiny sort of world kind of thing, would work nicely in 3D. I know, Andy, you love Pikmin. I mean, would that appeal to you?
I would. That's one way to make me a launch day consumer right there. I would be so all over that it hurts.
I like Pikmin a lot as well.
See, I feel like they've passed on... I mean, obviously there was new play control Pikmin, but I feel like they so continually passed on it on the Wii that it just doesn't feel right.
Well, maybe it is a bit of wishful thinking on my part in this case, but I just think perhaps the reason why they've passed on a Wii is because they have other ideas for it, as nicely as it seems to work on Wii with the new play control being accepted. Almost seems like the 3DS is, what did John call it, the Island of Lost Toys or whatever. with like Star Fox and Pikmin ending up on it, but so it probably is a wee bit improbable, to be honest. But we live in hope. That's what these sorts of shows before E3 are really for.
Yeah, and then afterwards, we're all like, oh,
we're really just tweaking our listeners. I mean, we're just
no one ever predicted a Metroid first-person shooter for the
because
first
it's
DS.
A
that
bad
was...
idea.
But it was really impressive when they showed it. Like, that was sort of a
the first time, kind of and then it was like for the next 3 years.
Yeah, then it didn't come out till 2006. Yeah,
fair enough. But I'm just saying it wouldn't be completely out of the ordinary for them to just show something off that is completely unexpected and really impressive.
No, you raise a fair point from the point of view of the DS, which was, which has gone on to become rather this great juggernaut of expanding the audience and new kinds of experience and all that, was kind of one of its really big technical showcases was a first-person shooter.
That stupid demo that came with the DS that it was just awful. I think if I played that demo cart on the DSi XL, the world would end. I think it would just stop.
But before we close out this particular part of the E3 preview for this year, I wanted to obviously we concentrate on handhelds this time. Next week it'll be consoles, but I did want to get a quick poll of what we're expecting for Wii before we finish. So first question I have two is. They pretty much seem to have blown their load with Mario, Metroid, and Zelda, which we already know is going to be there. So could there possibly be another franchise announcement that would carry any weight at this point?
You don't mean a new franchise. You mean...
No, a game in an established franchise.
Greg, are you trying to get someone to predict Kid Icarus?
But would that even carry weight if they made it? I mean, that's kind of what I'm saying.
Matt Casamassina would silently drop one tier.
The answer is yes, Greg, and this is perfect for a late generation Wii title that will sell and will get people's eyes open a little bit at E3, and that's F-Zero. So I'm predicting a new F-Zero for Wii developed by someone who's never made an F-Zero game before. I think it could be Retro Studios.
Oh, that's deliciously off base. Interesting.
I thought you were going to say developed by Amusement Visions, now also known as Sonic Team.
Yakuza Racing. No.
Obviously Retro's project is going to be the subject of much intrigue. I'm sure we'll be talking about that more. Next time.
I'm kind of silently hoping we go through that E3 and they just don't announce anything. We're just like, what happened?
I would say that's my biggest fear of this E3 is just that we go through it and it's like, oh yeah, Retro still hasn't
announced.
That's
probably my biggest fear as well.
Well, I mean, Andy, aside from Pikmin, which of course we have been waiting for, I mean, what is it that Nintendo, given that they've dropped the big bombs already?
I would love to see a Mario football game. It's about time Mario actually played football. They've made every other sport for Mario. We haven't seen the deluge of Mario sports titles that we saw last generation on the GameCube. We've had a few. We've had like what, Strikers, and we've had. Baseball?
Charged, yes.
Was there a baseball game? Yeah, there was a baseball game.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
Lucas.
And it was not.
It was not great.
Both a while ago now.
So I would love to see them come back to the Mario sports franchise with Mario football.
I mean, maybe, obviously we know they're doing the Transformers game for Wii, but next level games. I mean,
sure.
Strikers seems to have gone quite well. Punch-Out. I mean, I am interested to see if they've got another partnership with Nintendo, and that sounds like the kind of thing they could do.
Yeah, I would love to see that.
You know, it's funny because ever since we've been doing this show, every year I've said, well, they're going to make Mario sports game that builds off Wii Sports.
Yeah.
It still gives you third time lucky.
It's been my Kid Icarus, and it's not going to happen. They basically said, you know what? Wii Sports is Wii Sports. This is this, and never the twain shall meet.
What's the announcement that Nintendo could make that would make the biggest impact on you?
On me personally?
Yeah, you personally.
Oh my god. I mean,
The Last Story, bringing it over or something?
Well, that is going to come over. I mean, I don't have any doubt. Just they'll make it come over if they brought over Dragon Quest IX.
Yeah.
But I think for me personally, it would be whatever the hell it is they've got hidden up in their development studios at this point. I mean, I don't even know what it would have to be, but there are so many people we can't account for that it's kind of like they're building something.
Do you think we might see Sakurai's game?
That's kind of what I'm thinking.
It's about the right time.
We predicted he would start showing up multiple times now. I think he's got to, like I said, he's got to be doing something, or he's taking Nintendo for one hell of a ride.
Oh, I like it. Well, I know the thing that would make the biggest impression on me, no doubt about it, is if Goodfeel were making a Wario Land Shake It style Yoshi game. That would be awesome.
Yoshi Land Shake It.
And the thing is, Yoshi, you know, Yoshi's back in, you know, a couple of the mainline Mario games now, and you know, stuff like Yoshi's Island DS sold about as many copies in Japan as Galaxy did. I mean, he's still bank.
So it's called Yoshi Land Lick It.
Yeah. Using the pointer for the tongue and the eggs and all that. I mean, it seems to make a hell of a lot of sense to me. After what they did with Shake It, Goodfeel, I think would be good custodians of Yoshi. So.
I'm looking forward to the vertical bars.
We could have nice little sort of Tetris Attack style backgrounds.
Well, how about this? The other players can play Tetris in the bars while you're playing the game.
Sounds like Maboshi's Arcade. so I have one more prediction, and I think before he left IGN, I think Casa Messina actually kind of implied that there might be something moving on this front, but I could see the former Factor 5 guys doing a Rogue Squadron collection for Wii.
Mm.
So updating all three of the games, fixing the third one, and you know.
So by updating, you mean removing the on foot missions?
Well, I mean, or improving them at least. But I mean, the first one would be a pretty big upgrade because that was an N64 game,
right?
So yes, that would be remaking that game basically.
Yeah,
it's not a long game. But
see, the thing is, some of that game's content gets recycled in later games.
I guess that's the point, though. If you do like an anthology, you'd have to sort of make some cuts in some places and improvements in others.
It might be a best of kind of thing.
So it wouldn't be like a trivial undertaking if they did it.
No.
Oh, no. It would be a pretty big deal. You know, they'd add Wii controls. It may be, you know, the Star Fox that we're never going to get on Wii.
You know, Rogue Leader still probably looks better than the vast majority of Wii games out there.
Dude, yeah, they don't have to do much to Rogue Leader.
They said that. I mean, was it Ekbrett who basically said a few years ago that, you know, yeah, we had stuff on the launch game of Rogue Leader that looks better than half the shit coming out on Wii.
Easily.
I don't disagree. I'd be a big Star Wars guy. I'd be pretty pumped for that, personally.
Yeah, I need to go buy that.
Star Wars always sells.
We're now gonna finally close this out. Our final quick fire question: will either Cosmic Walker or Kirby Wii turn up at this event? Johnny, do we live in hope for Cosmic Walker coming back? Because that has disappeared big time.
Cosmic Walker, I think, has a good chance of surviving. I don't know if it would actually show up at E3. That may again just be the kind of an
Excitebot
also ran
treatment.
Maybe not that. Maybe it's at E3, but it's like in the back corner somewhere. I don't know. Maybe they just save it for TGS. But I think Cosmic Walker, I think it's still around.
All the games that it was showed with, as it Punch Out,
they've all been out for like a year.
Yeah, Sin and Punishment 2 is still not out in America.
Sin and Punishment 2 is now headed to its second E3.
Endless Ocean 2 is out. You know, we've seen more of stuff like Span Smasher or Fling Smash, whatever it's called now. Yeah. You know, some of the other stuff that was there. So I mean, whereas that is a deathly silence around it. I mean, that I am worried about that.
It's almost like Project Hammer had that period where it was just nothing.
Do not compare this to Project.
I'm just saying there was that period where like it's dead, right? And nobody's gonna.
And then
us.
It was dead. Yeah.
And then finally, it's like, yeah, we killed that.
Yeah, but Project Hammer sucked when they first showed it, so no one was really surprised that it was canceled. Cosmic Walker looks really cool. I think that could still come out. Kirby, not really expecting
Kirby
that.
You still keep showing up on the Japanese list. That's why I have to keep asking the question.
I think they should turn Kirby into a WiiWare game so they can finish it.
Cannabis curse.
I know, James, you have strong opinions on this from Carl's mailbag, but you're sticking by it.
To be fair, when I said so the email came in asking, he's referencing that, is Kirby coming out this year? And I said, and I sent Carl an email saying, let me handle this. In a word, no. I didn't intend for Carl to actually include that email as the answer. But that Kirby game never happened. I mean,
never happened.
Down the memory hole.
There is no Kirby.
We have about as good a chance of these two games showing up at E3 as them showing up in a crossover Kirby Cosmic Walker. I mean, honestly.
You never know.
Which, by the way, I would buy that game day one.
Yeah, well, there it is. That's going to have to leave it there. So just tune in next week, as Carl might say, for part two.
Tune in 3 weeks where everything we predicted is wrong.
Well, yeah, obviously that. Yeah, but you know, next week we're going to really tackle all the Wii stuff that we haven't got
and Wii HD.
Yeah.
Oh, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
It's coming. John Davison told me so a couple of years ago. So that is happening.
Did he call you at home?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we all know. We all know each other.
Yeah. So now we come to the close of another epic Radio Free Nintendo. And before we go, I want to first off thank Andy very much for doing this tonight.
Yeah, no problem. It's always fun.
You were great. And tell the people how they can hear more of you, Andy Gergen.
They could keep an eye out on the site every other weekend or on their podcast aggregator every other weekend for the NWR Newscast. We just recorded our 18th episode, put it out a couple weekends ago. Next week is 19. We've been pretty consistent for the past 6 months or so. It's getting kind of cool to see it actually kind of creeping up there in the numbers. But next week, Neil will be gone. So I believe you're actually going to be joining us, Johnny.
It's getting so much better all the time.
Yeah.
Yes, I recommend the Newscast, of course, and looking forward to doing that next week as we get ready for E3. And, of course, we always recommend that you check out Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. I just recorded a very fun episode with TYP a few days ago, and that will probably be out around the time that this episode's out. So look for that.
So this is the Johnny Podcast takeover, essentially, yeah. You're telling us.
Yes. Yeah, he's doing the Iron Man there.
Overexposure 2010. One last thing before we go. We need your awesome emails. We've had so many good ones lately, and the bag's running a little dry, unbelievably.
Oh, no.
We had a pretty consistent effort there for a while to really knock them all out. And
I blame Carl and his siphoning petrol.
That's part right. It's a competition between RFN and the mailbag. Don't you want RFN to win?
Send us the most bombastic, stupid questions you can, and we'll make fun of you better than Carl.
Invest in podcast war bonds by sending your email to rfn at nintendoworldreport.com.
This is like your metal recycling. We're going to bring us your pots and pans of email questions.
Yeah, rfn at nintendoworldreport.com. Send us emails. That's it. Look forward to John next week. Peace out. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
It seems like a bigger sin for Heavy Rain to screw up its story.
It's really an unforgivable sin. I mean, it's to the point where I don't think I would play any other game made by this guy.
Because, oh my god!
Well, I mean, he wrote...
Now you're building my intrigue up again.
I know, now I'm tempted. I'm like, how mad would I get?
He is the creative force of this game. He wrote the story.
You know, it's the kind of the full circle element that amuses me in terms of, you know, you go through all the, you know, all the years that it took to make the game and all the technical sort of expertise that it took to get, you know, to do so many things that were done, you know, relatively well with the storytelling, things that hadn't been done in the video game before.
Right.
And then, yeah, there were some stumbles in the execution with the voice acting, but in the end, you know, what really fails is the bit that the one guy penned, you
the
know, that's one person's
yes.
imagination on paper, and
exactly.
that didn't pass muster. That's exactly. that's kind of depressing.
It is depressing.
That everyone went on this 3-year voyage for a ship that was built out of shit. It just, I just don't. That's sad.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me about this game is that now, like, I really wasn't that interested in it before, but now I kind of want to do it just because Johnny has made declaratory statements of, I'm not going to play games made by this guy. After we did a fucking feature on a game he made, like, 70 episodes ago. It's like, wow, that is a 180 I have never seen before.
Sorry. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Like, a 1-hour sequence has completely destroyed his perspective of this guy's talent.
Yep.
Well, it's just like amazing that you can have a game like this that's so heavily story based, and you have all these people that are working to put this together, like you were saying, and yet like.
But you know, the same. It's not just games with these heavy story leverage things. I mean. It's because Sonic were beating up on the PS3, but think about Lair. Lair was in development for a long time. They had to know the controls didn't work. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Somebody at that company had to go, guys, holy shit.
That's a failure of management.
It is.
Yeah, but that's like steering some enormous dreadnought.
Well,
yeah,
it's kind of what the game is like playing, too, actually.
Yeah, whereas, whether the story can be changed or not, like, you could change, just take your pen out or your laptop and start writing again. You know what I mean? That is
working.
Not...
Yeah.
That is eminently changeable.
The pilot wings with two eyes.
There you go.
Oh, like Beanie. Yes.
I like that we've basically boiled all Nintendo's strategies down this conversation to the ability to make puns with the name.
You know, and you know, and the other game that I would
we've hit Shitville again.
Mike.
Yeah, Mike.
I'll be right back.
So close.
Yikes.
Fucking hell, it's like Metroid 2.
Exactly. It sounded exactly like Metroid 2. We thought, Greg, we're really in sync tonight.
He also does not come with a map.
Oh, God. Did anything I said about Pilot Wings come over?
Yeah, it was
a fair bit of Pilot Wings.
It was like Pilot Wings, period. Boosh.
Okay, and honestly, I don't really even give a shit about Pilot Wings. I could care less.